Good evening, everybody. Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, June 13th, 2016. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern Standard Time. If you're listening live over another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, our call-in number is 605-562-3140, and our participant code is 385-698. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send questions to questions, that's plural, questions, at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of our website, of which the proceeds go to support National Liberty Alliance's effort to save America. Also, please consider supporting National Liberty Alliance by donating $5 a month or more. Click on our donation tab up on the top right, right above the blue bar. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is Proverbs chapter 28, verses 1 through 7. The wicked flee when no man pursueth, but the righteous are bold as a lion. For the transgression of a land many are the princes thereof, but by a man of understanding and knowledge the state thereof shall be prolonged. A poor man that oppresseth the poor is like a sweeping rain which leaveth no food. They that forsake the law praise the wicked, but such as keep the law contend with them. Evil men understand not judgment, but they that seek the Lord understandeth all things. Better is the poor that walketh in his uprightness than he that is perverse in his ways, though he be rich. Whoso keepeth the law is a wise son, but he that is a companion of riotous men shameth his father. Okay, that was Proverbs chapter 28, verses 1 through 7. okay, tonight, well, first, let's see, is Gary here? Do we have any questions? Jan, I don't see Gary. Gary's not here tonight? You're probably muted. But I guess Gary's not here tonight, so you don't have any questions. You don't get the questions in the mail, do you, Jan?
No, they don't come to
me. Okay. Anyway, then I guess we don't have any questions tonight. If anything came in, I guess we'll try to cover it next week. So, okay. I don't have too much to share. You know, a couple of things. We are moving forward. Just some announcements. We're moving forward with habeas corpus. We've got a couple of people that are working on trying to bring the paperwork together so that we can start getting back to the habeas corpuses. You know, I don't know if we're going to get some. I'm planning on getting some out this week. I hope to have gotten it out last week, but, you know, it takes time to get people together to get all on the same page and try to work out the different things. And, of course, the way the paperwork was kept prior is quite different than the way we're setting it up right now. So there's kind of a changeover in the way we're going to proceed, I think, a lot simpler in process. We had gathered a lot of information that we didn't need, and so we got to go through the stuff and only pull out what we do need for doing habeas corpuses. But anyone that is interested in a habeas corpus that has one in, it's important to realize that we only need certain pieces of information. We're only doing a habeas corpus, which is challenging ultimately their jurisdiction because you're not getting due process. So in the process of challenging the due process requirement and requiring due process through a habeas corpus, they don't have the proper jurisdiction, or they're going to go through the proper processes in order to give anyone their due process. So that's how, you know, often, of course, the habeas corpuses usually pull people out of other courts. Now, of course, they are rejecting or resisting us, shall I say. But every time we file a habeas corpus, the more pressure is on the system. We file 28. That shows conspiracy. It also shows the fact that they're resisting due process to we the people. It looks like we've got another 28 habeas corpuses, you know, almost ready to go. I'm going through all the files right now with some people and trying to put it all together, as I mentioned. It's going to take a little time. And I think we're going to end up, you know, there may be some information that might be missing. We'll make the phone call to those people. I think what we'll do is we're going to set a page up, okay, and we'll announce that next week when that page goes up. And on that page, we'll probably have the status of all the paperwork that we have that we're working on. And so you'll know, you know, what we have. And if we're missing anything, we'll put some kind of a symbol or something for what it is that we might need in order to move that case forward. We're getting a little closer to catching up on the bills, but we're still not caught up on bills. You know, some people have been helping out whenever we go out for a call for need for money, and some people have been very generous and has helped out. And I'm asking for the people who have not helped out. I'm asking for the people who have never given. If you believe that this is an important thing that we're doing, and that this is the solution to the saving of America by God's mercy, then please support us. It's extremely important that you support us. So I'm asking for anybody who has never given, please at least go up and give a donation right now or tomorrow morning. You know, you can go up to the top right-hand side above our bar, click on donation, and you can make a donation by through PayPal, credit card, or you can send something through the mail. There's an address there. So please consider that. Also, everyone, please consider a regular donation of $5 a month or more to support what we're doing. We do need to catch up. We're getting closer, but we're still not there. We're still behind in our bills. We just are struggling with that. And so anything that anyone could do would be appreciated. Okay. Let's see what else we have here. No questions. All right. Like I said, the habeas corpus, we will get back to it. Anybody who is putting in for habeas corpus, I want to make this absolutely clear. We've made it clear on the, as clear as we can on the website, and we're also now requiring anybody who wants to get a habeas corpus done, they need to be taking the civics course. They need to be taking the constitutional course. They need to get involved in an education because some people have come to National Liberty Alliance just for a habeas corpus and then don't pay attention to what's going on. They haven't got a clue. And they don't know, that we've had situations and, you know, with the habeas corpuses and, you know, that it's been put aside for a while and that we're coming back to start again. They have no clue, even though we send out email. Maybe they're not members. So we're going to require people to take in the civics course. If you're not taking that civics course and you're not taking the constitutional course, I'd say take the constitutional course first and the civics course second. If you're not doing that, we're not going to do a habeas corpus. The reason, main reason is you got to get involved and educated a little bit. How can you expect a process or go through the courts that you're asking us to do and not understand it? So let's get educated a little bit. We've got a lot of educational material up there that you can look into and read and listen to all kinds of audios and read quite a bit of information. But the key thing, I think, is starting off with that civics course, with the constitutional course and the civics course. Let's see if Gary's on yet. Okay, Gary's still not on, so I guess we'll go forward without questions. All right, we're going to move over to Brent Winters and then over to Gerard. Brent Winters is the author of Excellence in Common Law. His website is commonlawyer.com, commonlawyer.com. And Brent, go right ahead. You got the mic. *6 to unmute yourself. Well, maybe you are unmuted. Let's see. No, you're muted. Let me unmute you. Yeah, there you go. You've unmuted yourself.
Thank you, John.
Okay.
I like to stay on my subject when I talk, and I don't want to talk about myself, but in this particular instance, I've got to make a couple of comments, I think, to be to fill some responsibilities. I haven't said this before, but people have contacted me that have listened to these presentations and requested help or asked me questions, and that's not a problem, but I am not licensed to practice law in all of the states of the Union unless it's federal court. That's possible in that case, but I'm just licensed in one state. I can get into other state courts, but it's not easy always, and it's difficult because of the travel. So don't call me and contact me as though there were a strong possibility I could represent you in state court or sometimes even federal court. And I appreciate one of our callers calling this to my attention. And he didn't understand that, and I didn't explain it. So I apologize for not having done so, and I do so now so that people will know what my limitations are. I am a lawyer, licensed to practice, but I can't practice in every state. And I'm here at invitation of John and the others, Gerard, and I want to talk about things that are important to our dire circumstances. And I believe that the only remedy for lawlessness, and that's what we see about us, is law, true law. And therefore, I want to talk about the limits of government as our law understands it. And we've been going over the militia clauses of the United States Constitution. There are four of them. And we're ready to start talking about the third militia clause. The first militia clause, in quick review, is about the Congress, the responsibilities of Congress concerning the militia of the several states. The second militia clause concerns the responsibility of the state governors and state legislature concerning the militia of the several state of any particular state. The third militia clause concerns the presidents of the United States' role respecting the militia of the several states. And the fourth militia clause, which we call the Second Amendment also, concerns not granting any powers, but recognizing and protecting the responsibilities of the militia of the several states, and that is to keep and carry a loaded gun, to put it in more modern terms. We're ready to start then talking about the third militia clause. The third militia clause appoints the president, it's about presidents, and it appoints the president commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states of the Union. Let me repeat that. The third militia clause appoints the president of the United States, whoever's sitting at that time, appoints him commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states, but only when called into actual service of the United States. Thus, the president commands only those militiamen whom Congress, by its criteria provided according to the first militia clause, has allowed him to call forth, and after having been mustered into actual service, then he has command over them. And further, the command of a president over the militia of the several states, or any part of the militia of the several states, must be according to the regulations that Congress has provided. So let me read this one. This is the third militia clause. That's Article 2, Section 2, Clause 1, says this. Says the president shall be commander-in-chief of the militia of the several states, now watch this, when called into the actual service of the United States. And although our Constitution's third militia clause sets forth the president's duties respecting the militia of the several states, those duties are part of the executive power our Constitution sets forth in the clause previous to the militia clause. The clause previous to the militia clause of our Constitution says this. It says, the executive power shall be vested in a president of the United States. That's Article 2, Section 1, Clause 1. And this, the president's executive power is the power to enforce the laws and treaties of the United States. And his tools for this duty are the armed forces of the United States, that's the Army, Navy, Air Force, and Marines, and the militia of the several states once called out and mustered. And because his executive duties require more resources than the other two branches of government, most federal employees, most of those folk getting a paycheck from the federal treasury are under the direction of the executive branch. That means they're under the direction of the president of the United States. Simply put, our Constitution gives the president a near monopoly of force and violence, limited only by the other two branches' objections of words and the people's, that's the militia's, convictions or lack thereof. The president's powers are far-reaching, and they're limited only by the other two branches of government, the Congress and the Supreme Court, and the objections of the militia, that's the people. That's important to understand and know what limits. It's easy to know where the lawful limits of the president's powers are. But to know how he is kept within that pin, how he's kept within that boundary, the militia of the several states was intended to be key in keeping him within that boundary. And I am convinced from reading history and watching what goes on now and has gone on, that much of our problem here in the United States stems from what Justice Story said was his greatest fear in his commentaries on the Constitution. His greatest fear was that we would ignore the four militia clauses of our Constitution, because he saw that was where the real power was, to limit domestically the power of the president. As a constitutional rule, however, the president has authority over only navigable waters within the United States, that's rivers that are capable of commerce, ships and men on the high seas under the United States flag, persons and things within the United States territories, the District of Columbia, and federal lands and enclaves within the states, such as federal courthouses and military bases. Bottom line, the president has authority as an executive power over navigable waters within the United States, ships on the high seas flagged under the United States, and property within the United States, real property, that the federal government owns, territories in the District of Columbia. But most important, the militia of the several states is the only means of executive power our Constitution allows the president to use within any territory or on any property other than those I've just mentioned within the United States. And he only has authority with the militia of the several states to I'm quoting the Constitution, to execute the laws of the Union, suppress insurrections, and repel invasions. It might be a good way to put it the other way around than saying what the president and the federal government, the president, has executive power over within the states. I said navigable waters and federal property, territories, District of Columbia. But we could put it this way also, turn it the other way around and say the president's executive powers do not apply, are not applicable. He has no authority to exercise them within the boundaries of any state of our union, except federal property owned within those states. That's where the rubber really meets the road with this question of his executive power within the continental United States, Alaska, and Hawaii. The restrictions and the following rules Congress has provided, or following the rules Congress has provided, is what is supposed to limit him. That is the president. Never forget, every clause of our Constitution is meant to limit the authority, power, and reach of the national government. I'm going to say that one again. Every clause of our Constitution is meant to limit the authority, power, and reach of the national government sitting in Washington, D.C. And if any provision of our Constitution is not understood that way, then it's being misunderstood. If the result that is given by the courts to some decision, in fact, provides more power to the federal government in result than the Constitution provides, then the decision is wrong. It's unconstitutional. And it's the people's responsibility to say so. Listen, that's why only in America and a few other countries in the world, a few other common law countries, only here are dissenting opinions of justices even allowed. And we don't allow them here. We expect them. It's part of our custom and culture. And that's not true in most of the world. And the reason we do that is so we can complain about what they're doing and talk about it and possibly change their decisions or their point of view. And by the second militia clause, placing ultimate command of the armed forces of the United States in the hands of a president, it places that command and control in non-military hands. And we've said this often. I mean, if you've taken high school history of the United States, you've had to have heard this. It's said often. It's good to remind ourselves. The commander-in-chief of our military forces is not a military man. He's a non-military man. And by American custom, and in keeping with this clause of the United States Constitution, No president of the United States, even in times of all-out war, has ever donned a military uniform in office. Now, that's something's not talked about a lot, but that is striking in its contrast to the rest of the world, where even in the common law country of England, the sovereigns, the king, dons military dress, the princes don military dress. That's unacceptable in America that any president would ever do that. I'm reminded even when the military head of the American forces, in other words, the general in charge, fled from British troops, abandoned his command against when the British troops invading Washington, D.C. advanced upon the White House, he left, and President Madison, the sickly and really small man that he was, he'd been sickly all his life, he ran out of the White House and took command at the head of the United States Army in non-military dress and led them in a counterattack against the British forces unsuccessfully. But I've always thought a lot of Madison for that. He did it when he had to do it and no one else could do it. And he wasn't the kind of a fella anybody would have ever expected to do it, but he faced the ugly bullets. Unfortunately, he wasn't killed. And though the president's powers as commander-in-chief are far-reaching, even in wartime, in all events, the president of the United States, and this is important in our current circumstances here, the president must obey the law of the land. The law of the land. Article 6 of our Constitution calls our common law the law of the land. And our common law is a matter of process. We've mentioned that, and we'll say it again, no doubt. He must stay within the bounds of our Constitution, no matter what he does. And he must never suspend the writ of habeas corpus as long as non-military, that is, the common law courts, are open. Our Constitution never mentions, much less establishes, or gives authority for, or otherwise recognizes, any militia of the United States. It only recognizes the militia of the several states. That's an important distinction, and we should be reminded of it, and it should be part of our psyche. Let me say it again. There is no militia of the United States. None. The only militia our Constitution recognizes is the militia of the several states. And that's important, by the way, that's important because it is the individuality and the sovereignty of the states and the militia of the several states that those that drafted our Constitution and those that ratified our Constitution wanted to use to limit the power of presidents more than any other part of our Constitution. Since no national militia has ever existed before our Constitution, and since our Constitution never includes or otherwise establishes any national militia, any attempt to do so is unconstitutional. Before our independence from Britain, the militias were of the separate 13 states, colonies, turn states. There never was a national militia. And so when our Constitution went in force, it never recognized any national militia, only the militia of each of the separate states. Our national government has only the powers the Constitution enumerates, only the powers it lists. And however, our Constitution our Constitution does recognize and further strengthens the militia of the several states because it is the only way to have, this is important, the militia of the several states is the only way to have homeland security without having to forfeit freedoms at the same time. If the bureaucrats tell us they'll give us freedom, the TSA, the FBI, the CIA, whoever they are, if the bureaucrats say we'll give you freedom, they will always say, and Congress will say, but you've got to give up, or we'll give you security. If they say we'll give you security, the bureaucrats will always say, but you got to give up this much freedom. Witness what goes on with the TSA. That's just one example. There are many others. If the military says, we're going to give you security when Katrina hit New Orleans, we're going to give you security. The Army was there. But you got to give up your guns, and they took the guns from the people. Security and freedom are not possible at the same time. Never have been, never will be, without the militia of the several states being paid attention to, and those four clauses being paid attention to. Unlike policemen and police forces, the people of the United States, the people, that is the militia, are trustworthy to never oppress the people. The people are trustworthy. That's who the militia is. And they're trustworthy never to oppress the people. Bureaucrats can be trusted to oppress the people. Count on it. And military forces brought in among us, policemen, count on it, will oppress. Once they're given the power, that's what they'll do. The militia won't have that problem. And police forces, blind and brainless obedience to orders in calloused disregard of the Constitution, each of them has sworn to defend and protect, should move every freedom-loving American not to rebellion, but simply to fill their God-given duty to their God-given stewardship of freedom. That means fulfill your responsibility. Responsibility, that's what a right is under the Second Amendment. Well, I suppose that's about 40 minutes, John. I can quit there. I'm willing to hang around again if you have time for any questions. I think I've gone about 20 minutes.
Okay, thank you, Brett. Give me a second there to find my mic to unmute it, but okay, appreciate it. All right, let's go to Q&A. If anybody has any questions or comments for Brent, we're going to let Brent take some questions. So anybody who would like to ask a question or make a comment, hit star 6 to get into the queue for questions for Brent. Okay, we'll take our first caller. We have Terry from Colorado. You should be unmuted. Go right ahead, Terry from Colorado.
Hi, thank you, John. I just wanted to ask a general question. How do you become a common lawyer and able to work inside of a court?
Yes, I'm sorry. Were you finished?
No, I'm finished. I thought
okay.
of that last just before you, so I'm sorry.
From where are you calling?
Colorado.
Nice to talk to you. Well, there's a lot of misconception, and I'm glad you mentioned it because it gives me a chance to try to unscrew the unscrutable to some people or take away a little fog if possible. There's only two kind of lawyers in the world, two kinds of lawyers. Is it two kind or two kinds? I'll have to check that out, but some people say it one way, some another. There are only two kinds. There are lawyers of the law of the land. Those are called common lawyers traditionally. And there are lawyers of the laws of the city. Those are called city lawyers, and in the Latin most commonly called civil lawyers, because civil is the Latin word for city. So there are lawyers of the civil law, and there are lawyers of the common law. Lawyers in the United States, all of them in the United States, with the exception of Louisiana, but even there, they have to be, to a certain degree, lawyers of the common law, because our federal courts overlay wrong, unconstitutional decisions, or we hope they do, of the state courts of Louisiana. All lawyers in the English-speaking world, let me carry it a step further, all lawyers in the English-speaking world, Scotland's a civil law country, England, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the United States, and their protectorates, places like Guam, and of course Britain has places like that around the world, like British Honduras, now Belize. Those are all common law countries, and all the lawyers in those countries are common lawyers. What is the difference? There are fundamental differences, and the fundamental differences between the two make them like night and day, but they're unwritten and they're hardly ever mentioned. And many of them I've outlined in my in the comparative law text, Excellence of the Common Law, Excellence of the Common Law, by Brent Allen Winters. If you type in my name at Amazon, you can find the book. It's if you're interested in that subject, people tell me it's worth reading. Of course, I like to look at it. I forget what I've written, and I go back and review it. I just did a lot of research over the years and my experiences in the courts, and I wrote it down, and if you want to look at it, I've got some of the major differences outlined there, and I want you to read it. I won't be bashful about it. It's important that somebody read it because we've lost the distinction. Now, to go into the courts in the United States to argue for another person, to represent another person, you have to have a law license. Law licenses in the United States, in every state, it's a state-by-state thing, law licenses, that means you can argue for another person before a judge in a court. They're issued at the pleasure of either the Supreme Court of one of the states of the United States. Some of the states, it's from the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court has control of lawyers in those states, the Supreme Court of that state. Or in some states, such as California, the state bar has control and discipline of lawyers, and the state bar controls who is licensed and who isn't. If you're in a state like California and you want to practice law, bar membership of that state's bar is mandatory. You can't practice law without joining the bar because they're the ones that issue the license. In other states, like, for example, Illinois, where the Supreme Court of the state controls lawyers' discipline and issues license, you don't have to belong to the State Bar Association. It's just another club people can join if they'd like to. I hope that clears up the question a little bit, does it, or did I get to what you were looking for?
Yeah, it's so often I compare what's in common law, and I am about I'm somewhere up at about 330 or 350 on the Excellence of the Common Law. And it sounds like what we have here, a lot of the customs that we have came from the common law tradition, but they're trying to conduct it like civil law.
That's correct. I'm glad you're noticing that, and I hope some lawyers start to notice it. But it's an orchestrated plan from the evil empire to destroy the common law in America. It's been an orchestrated conspiracy. Yes, a conspiracy. A conspiracy is an agreement to break the law, to do wrong. That's all it is. No big deal. It's been an organized conspiracy since the days of King Alfred the Great back in the 9th century. And the story of the English-speaking world beginning in England, the story, its history, is the story of the battle between the jurisdiction of the courts of the Roman Church, beginning there, the courts of Rome, civil law, and the common law courts of England. And there have been a lot of close calls through the centuries, and every war we've had, the wars that were in England, the Civil War in England, as they called it, of the 1640s, the American War for Independence was a continuation of that war. And Winston Churchill made this comment, and I can see it clearly in history. It's always the same. The Civil War in England was about the king, the crown, he wanted the civil law to rule England. John of Magna Carta, he had sold out to Rome. He had turned the whole country over to Rome. He had promised to let the Roman courts, which were church courts, but they were creeping in equity into our other courts. The battle, let me take it back even further. The only battle that the race of Adam has ever had on our planet is the battle between the law of the city and the law of the land. And as you know, my text starts at Babylon because that's where the law of the city was first organized in any recognizable way, and it became big there, and everything has come out of Babylon. And as Maitland, the English, I should say British historian of our common law from 100 and some years ago, not just over 100 years ago, said, if we want to understand the civil law, that's the law of the city, we must study Babylon. That's where it came from. Went to Pergamos, went to Rome, went to Babylon. It's gone to cities all over the world now. It must have a city, a central city. Rome is now the central city, has been, and still looked upon that way. Moscow, Berlin, both tried to be the new Roman Empire. They have the law of Rome, as all countries of the world now do, except the English-speaking world. And there's an orchestrated plan to get rid of it here and now, just not many years ago, about 10 years ago, I forget exactly which year it was, the common law first-year courses at Harvard were replaced with courses and forms of the law of the city. Some of the fundamental, there are fundamental common law courses you take first year in law school. Those have been replaced, and it was done at the behest of the person now sitting on the Supreme Court. I don't know what to call her. Him. I don't know what it is. But, yeah, pushed at Harvard. That person was dean at Harvard at the time. That's orchestrated. They want to get rid of it because with it, by the way, comes the jury. The jury doesn't exist anywhere in the world with any real jury effectiveness. They feign it in some places, such as Austria and places like that, but it doesn't exist. That's just window dressing to make people think they have rights. We get rid of the jury, we're done. That's the idea. And if you've noticed, and you probably have, more and more, it's tougher to get a jury trial. I've noticed just the time I've been in it, not that long in the span of history. It's tough. Yeah, anyway, you're right. And yeah, go ahead, John.
No, I'm sorry. I just want one more question, if I may. I don't mean to take up so much time. But in Colorado, the state in the Colorado Constitution turned it over to the Bar Association for the state. And the Bar Association of the state requires that you go to school and get indoctrinated into all this other junk before they will approve you, and then take the bar exam. So you have to have an accredited college and then be a member of the Bar Association before you can practice law. And I think that's outrageous. And how do I get around that?
Ever Dirksen, senator, well-known senator, maybe you remember him from Illinois, he was leader of the Senate for years, he wanted to get so he could go to court and argue for other people, and he ended up going to Washington, D.C. and taking the bar there. I never went to college, never went to law school. He just went to D.C., passed the bar. I don't know what the rules are with that. I've known people that have gone to D.C., District of Columbia, passed the bar, and then tried to you can get into other courts and use that as a stepping stone to get into other courts. There are different ways to do it. Now, up in Wisconsin, if you graduate from a Wisconsin law school, you don't have to take the bar in Wisconsin. You are a lawyer, and you can practice, and you have a license if you get through school. But it's either the getting in that's hard, jumping the hoops to get in. If that's easy, well, jumping the hoops to get out of whatever you're supposed to get into is hard. Like they say, it's hard to get into Harvard, but once you're in, you don't have to do much. They don't teach you much. You need to get out. I'm exaggerating. There's a lot of Ivy League schools like that, but the bar is kind of like that. See, the bar exam is the final hoop, and you'd think, well, if you passed a bar exam, why would you even need to go to college? And that's your point, and I understand your point. And it is true that when you take the bar exam, you learn a lot of things you didn't learn in school. You're indoctrinated. But now we don't want to go too far with that. Just to go back, when the common law or when common lawyers first appeared upon the scene, they appeared upon the scene after the Norman invasion because there were about 6,000 Normans running the whole country of England, and they spoke what we call a bastardized Norman French. They were people descended from people from Norway that lived on the coast of France. They'd picked up the French language. They brought it to England, and the courts and the government of England was operated in this bastardized French from the time of the invasion in 1066 till the middle of the 14th century. Well, during that time, because the courts were run by priests a lot of times, and that that became a problem in England because the civil law was creeping in. You see, a Roman priest is not a student of the Bible at all. A Roman priest is a Roman lawyer. He's a Roman civil lawyer. He's a lawyer of the canon law of Rome, that is the civil law. And they're very educated, of course. They're big on education. They know that stuff. and they were putting them in the courts. Well, then, but the people that ran the courts were speaking French, and 200,000 or more Anglo-Saxons and Anglo-Danes live in England, and they spoke English. They couldn't get a hearing in court. So usually somebody who could speak both languages started helping people, neighbors, friends, family, and it, that developed a class of men that they called themselves lawyers, and they began to receive honorariums for representing people in court. And then they said, well, we can't get into the university, we can't get into Oxford to get educated, because the universities are the product of Rome again. Rome wouldn't let any... No common law was taught at Oxford until William Blackstone delivered his lectures in 1765. They wouldn't allow it because they were controlled by the Roman civil law. And every university in the world, by the way, is a product of Rome. And the degree system and all that, that's all Babylonian to the hilt. Read about it. The first university on the face of the planet was founded in Bologna, Italy in 1053. And for the express purpose, the Pope of Rome issued his bull. The express purpose of that university was to supplant the Bible and replace it with the Code of Justinian, which is the Code of Rome, which is the Code of Babylon in its modern form. All these things happen. They're still happening, and they're happening now with a vengeance like they've never happened before, because the law of the city has spawned Islam. And Rome had a hand in that, and their doctrine and law is the same. There's a lot of sexual perversion in both of them. And then the Talmudic law of the Pharisees, same thing. That's why Jesus Christ railed against them so hard. A lot of perversion, but a lot, it comes down to they're just comfortable with a dictator. That's a one-man show. Let's not make this complicated. It's not something that takes a lot of intellectual ability to understand. They put one man in charge, or they put the government in under one will. One will. Such as the will, combined will, of many men in a legislature. That's tyranny, and that's what the law of the city is all about. We here in America, I hope we're doing this, bust the power up. We got 50 states, we've got branches of government, we've got independent courts. That's the theory anyway in a common law tradition. In the civil law world, there are no independent courts. Every judge in South America, every judge on the continent of Europe is a civil servant in the civil service system, educated not to be a lawyer, not to understand the law, educated specifically to be a judge. That's the Roman system. And there's no way, in other words, he's got to please his employer, or he's not going to get a promotion, and he's going to get fired. There is no independence of judges, and there are no juries. The differences are stark, and anyone who has American sensibilities would be sickened to the point of puking his guts out if he went into a French court and watched what went on there. It's that bad. And the same is true throughout the world and in the Orient also. In China, they're under the law of Rome, the Code of Justinian, Japan, all those places, Vietnam. Of course, Vietnam is French to start with. And that's just to respond. It's important. The distinctions are stark, and this spells the difference between freedom and tyranny, and where it's coming. And because we don't understand that there is a difference, you know, you go to college, places like these funky professors, they teach you things like there are seven forms of government. No, there aren't. There have always been two. There never will be more than two, and that's it. You know, Abe Lincoln observed that in his debates with Douglas. But when they say there's seven forms of government, that confuses people. Who's got time to learn all that baloney and shades of meaning? That's not the way it works. No, God doesn't operate that way. He presents government to the world in two forms. He presents everything in two forms. It's simple. You just got to pay attention to it and organize your mind to it and say, no, this is simple. There's heaven and there is earth. There is skies and there is the land. That's the first statement in the Bible. All of the laws of nature, and the laws of nature is God, the laws of nature is unwritten in creation. The laws of nature is God, written in the Bible. I'm quoting Blackstone, quoting our Declaration of 76. All of it comes in twos. There's right and there's wrong. There's up, there's down. There's saints and there's ain'ts. And there's the law of the city and the law of the land. And by the way, the conflict of those two laws is the theme of the Bible from start to finish. The only city that's mentioned, more than Babylon in the Bible. Babylon is the mother of all false government, false law, false religion. The only city that's mentioned more is Jerusalem. It's Babylon versus Jerusalem. That's the way it's been since, I should quit. It just overwhelms me the more I talk about it, the stark black and white difference.
I love it.
Yeah.
You just reinforced everything I've been reading for the last 6 months trying to
maybe that's what you needed.
And I really needed that. Thank you very much, sir. It is a pleasure to talk to you.
Oh, good talking to you, too, and I appreciate the question.
Thank you. I yield.
Thank you, Terry. Appreciate the questions. Okay, let's take our next caller. It's Jody from Michigan. You've been unmuted. Go right ahead, Jody.
Hi, John. Hi, Brent. I have a question and then a couple of comments. Regarding with Homeland Security, I have heard that they are foreign entities and that they are taking jurisdiction over the Coast Guard, and not all the time, but some of the time. Can you comment on that?
I will comment, and I can only comment as far as I read. I know what I read, but I'm convinced from my experiences and from history, it has to be true, foreign enemies are constantly and have been forever, it's never stopped, have tried to gain control of our government. You know, it's the evil empire, what it needs is an organization. But the evil empire never forms organizations. The evil empire steals them. It steals organizations like the NRA and makes everybody think that the NRA is doing the bidding. They make a show of it, and that money just keeps rolling in. I could cite a lot of examples like that, and governments are that way. Once an organization begins, the great struggle is, how do you keep the evil empire, the subversives, the useful idiots, from gaining control of it? I once had a historian, an accomplished historian, who was in his older years, not a young man. He was up in his 80s, and he told me that there has never been, and I just use this as one example. I don't care whether it's a university, a college, the church, whatever it is. He said there's never been a denomination of religion, a church organization, in the history of Christianity that's ever lasted in its fundamental purpose, its proper purpose, for much over about 100 years. And that's why people keep breaking off and saying they can do it better. Sometimes they do it worse. But there are those people that do it better. That's just the church. We call it the church. And it's necessary that those things happen. But don't think there's an organization out there, whether it be the John Birch Society, the government of the United States, that's not soiled and controlled. It's beyond question that there are foreign nationals in high positions in our government, running our government, citizens of other countries, on the cabinet of this fellow sitting in the White House. No question. There's no question that the counterpart to the CIA and foreign states run the government of the United States. Just notice who the most powerful PAC in Washington, D.C. is. Just go to the Internet and type in who's the most powerful political action committee in Washington, D.C. I needn't say more. Go look. It's all there. But here's the answer. The answer isn't for us. We try to do the thing like the guy when I was a kid back in the 1950s. He went bonkers in the end. He was so upset. McCarthy tried to root communism out of the United States, and Richard Nixon got his start that way. There were things that need to be done. He wasn't all wrong, but ultimately he didn't do it. It was here since the 1920s, since World War I, and on through the 30s, and I can cite the names of the people, and it lasted through the 50s. The collectivists were there. But the answer to all of that is not to try to root them out so much. No, we're not going to do that. The answer is the militia of the several states. If we but would pay attention to those clauses and demand that those in government pay attention, the sheriffs, the state governors, forget the federal government. I'm about to the point we just say we need to say no. We need the states and the sheriffs and the attorney generals to stand up and say, no, we're not participating anymore. You have a shooting down in, what's the name of this place? Florida had a shooting down there. Next thing you know, they're trying to use it as an excuse to send Americans overseas to murder people by the thousands. That's what's happening. It's that crazy. And the way to stop that is the militia of the several states. If we went full hog on that, it would do it. But let me give you another point of view, too. It's not just that. If we do anything right and do it whole hog, it would stop all this. If we had sound money, whole hog, we went after it and the state said no more. It would stop all this. Pick any major doctrine of our common law, go at it whole hog, make it work, and it would stop all this. You don't have to do everything. You know, what does it say? It doesn't take much, and the Bible says this, to cover a multitude of sins. And if you just do something right, a lot of things go right. But we got to pick something out. And I do think, then this has been mentioned on this program by other people, that the sheriffs, the governors, and the attorney generals of the states are, they're the ones that are, would be most responsive. And it's not, as I said a while ago, it's not a matter of rebellion. That's not going to help us. It's not a matter of states saying we're leaving the union. That's not going to help. What's going to help is states and just people in their own jurisdiction, in their own bailiwick, saying no. Governors saying, I stand between the tyranny and the madness and the murder of the federal government and the debauchery. I stand between that and the people of the state that elected me. That's what has to be done. Sheriffs can do that too. But yeah, those things are going on. They've always gone on. They're not going to stop going on. And the answer is, the answer to the lawlessness is law. I appreciate that question,
that's
too.
That's a good answer. Sure. Can I just make a comment or two while I'm at it here? I just recently got access to a Rules of Court book, and I noticed in that rule book it's stating that habeas corpuses cannot be put through a probate court. And I was shocked. And apparently, from what I understand, is it the Supreme Court judges that are actually writing these rules? And are those rules laws, or are they, is this something that they're doing illegally that is just, judicial orders?
Well, as long as, I don't know exactly what happened to your state, but as long as you have a court you can go to, you're not being deprived of the right to file a habeas corpus. But a probate court is traditionally, it has descended from the old church courts, the old equity courts, the old chancery. And in a probate court, you don't have a lot of the things that you would have in what we call a straight common law court. That's a family court. That's a court that doesn't have a jury, by the way, as it's not, strictly speaking, a common law court. Don't be upset by that. You just have to find out which court, and I'm sure you have, wherever you are, you're Michigan, you said, you have courts of general jurisdiction there, state courts that will hear habeas corpus cases.
Okay, all right. And another thing that I'm noting here, and I wish I had a good governor and a good attorney general and a sheriff here, at least in my county, but that's not so. It's very scary. And I've had a very, difficult personal experience with my attorney general. I'm extremely disappointed, and he wants to be governor here next. It's very bad. So anyways, I forgot what I was going to say now.
Well, you're like me on what you're saying.
Yeah, I kind of went off a little bit, but I wanted to get to the point that I was making, which I'm not sure if I can. So I'll, I guess I'll just have to, I don't think, get it.
Well, Lord willing, we'll be back next week, and you may think of it.
Right, exactly. Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Jody. Appreciate the questions. Okay,
thanks,
let's
John.
Take, you're welcome, thank you. Let's take another caller, Ann from New Mexico. You got the mic.
I always understood that the federal government could not own property. They don't own the courts, do they? It's the people that own the courts. I always understood that the federal government could not own anything.
Well, no, the federal government owns a lot of things, and they have property, and Congress has absolute control of the disposition, whether they sell it or give it away. Property of the United States, everything from cargo planes to land. And sometimes they own it as trustees. There's thousands of acres that in the United States that federal government holds as trustees for the Indian tribes. I know it's true, and if you say the people own, what belongs to everybody belongs to nobody. If people say, well, everybody, the people, own the BLM land, well, that's not really sensible because, again, what belongs to everybody belongs to nobody, and if it belongs to everybody, nobody's got any rights. Somebody is in charge of that property and has say over what goes on with it. The government of the United States is, by necessity, whether they ever incorporate it or not, they're the law views that the government, all governments, is corporate entities that can hold title to real property. Now, the government, when we say the government owns the courts, I don't, obviously, the judge, let me put it this way. And when you're in a courtroom, the closest thing we probably got to God having power as a judge in his courtroom, limited by its walls, yes. He's very powerful there. If you want to use the word not title, but hey, he owns the courtroom, he owns it. It's his bailiwick. That's his jurisdiction in there in that sense. But that's not the governor doing that. The governor doesn't own that courtroom. He has to stay out. It's a judge's courtroom. I don't care whether he's a lowly trial judge or thinks he's a lowly probate judge. The governor of the state has no power there. He has to go someplace else. So your statement that the federal government can own, in my studied opinion, yes, they can own and do own and always have owned ships, warships. They've owned equipment and still do. But maybe, and I don't want to jump the gun and just go off talking, maybe you meant something else and maybe I misunderstood exactly what your question is. If so, maybe you clarify it a little bit.
Well, I had the understanding that they could not own property. The federal government could not own property, you know, land in United States.
It's contrary to our common law tradition that they would own land and not let anybody use it. I've been to Alaska in the last few years, a few times, and it's shocking. 98% of that state is big as a third the size of the continental United States. 98% or more. I'm stretching it. The government owns, and God doesn't like that. It's against the understanding, the tradition, the mandates of our common law. It's against the Bible. God said, "Be fruitful, multiply, and spread out." And it's been the policy of our common law that he who will not use land, it will be taken away from him and given to another. If another wants to come in and get it, if somebody else isn't using it, that goes back for centuries. It goes back to the Bible. Our common law goes back really far. You can trace it really far. And that's the fundamental covenant of God. And our Declaration of 76 makes that very complaint. That the King of England, through Parliament, of course, he thought he was emperor here, makes that complaint. You have cut off entry into lands. Lands are to be, if they belong to the United States or they belong to England, they had a duty under God to open it up to settlement. That's what land's for. It's not just to be out there and be beautiful. Well, anyway, the government does own land, but they own too much. They're not letting people on it. You've given me a platform to jump off and make another point that needs to be made. Land is power, and the government is not to own that much land and have that much power. It's not why it doesn't come into their possession to keep American people from the land. That's the point.
Let me just add something in there, if I might. Any land within the boundary of the state cannot be owned by the federal government, although they do make a claim on it, and of course that they really don't have any authority or right to do that. And that's something we the people have to fix.
And anyway. John, you make a point. No, it's a good point. And also, they can't own land. Well, they say they own land within the states, but the states can give them permission to be there and under the Constitution. And they've done that in several cases. And if you remember the war between the states, that was a point of contention that sparked the whole thing off at Fort Sumter. But anyway.
I would agree to that because that is some of the problem. I don't know that necessarily that is lawful, but particularly you can't call it a territory because territories have a definition and it's addressed in the Constitution. So they can't continue to call it a territory within a state. And where governors, I know in, I think it's in, let me see, let me take a look here. I think it's in, is it Arizona? No, it's not. Goodness, I forget which state so much of the... Oh, it's Utah. The state, a huge amount of Utah is owned or claimed by the federal government and is called territory. And I know that there is a battle by the government of Utah trying to take it back. So
yeah, and that's a good point. And 69 to 70% of the land the federal government claims in Nevada. Maybe it's better we say that the government does have the... They can occupy land within the states with the state legislature's permission. And that's how that happens. That's how they have military bases, federal courthouses.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
well,
what's going on.
I would agree to that as long as they the land that they're going after or need of qualifies with inside the Constitution, and ultimately that's all defined, you know, for dockyards and different government needs and purposes, other than the 10 square miles.
Well, it's important. It's important because it's overwhelming us, and we need more discussion on that point. And what
absolutely.
When we say own, I guess there's a difference between title. A judge doesn't have title to his courtroom, but he owns it in the sense that he's in charge there.
Yeah. As long as he's in there and he hasn't been arrested yet, he owns it.
Yeah. Well, maybe that's the way
that
federal governments within the states are there by permission. That's what the Constitution tells us, but it's not being followed that way.
Okay.
I want to add something to the land that Utah is trying to take back from the federal government. Their plan, the Utah plan, is just as egregious as the federal government's. They just want to replace one dictator from another with another. If you read their plan, they still plan on holding it and not letting the ranchers on it and controlling it, and that's a problem. It goes from there into everything else that they do, that they believe they have the authority to tax our land away from us until we don't own it anymore. These are all problems that we need to work out going forward.
Okay, appreciate that insight. Okay, let's go to our next person. Let's see. It's a phone number. Maybe you can give us your name and your state. You've got an open mic, 814-6760. 814.
Hello.
Yes, go right ahead. What's your first name and what state you're from?
My name is Clayton Schulze, and I'm from Pennsylvania.
Okay, Clayton from Pennsylvania. Go right ahead. What's your question or comment with Brent?
Well, what I'm looking for is common law, a court in Pennsylvania, because I have been pro seing several cases, and the court does not like a pro se client, and the judges are very partial in the things that I submit. Although it's true, they ignore it, and so I'm really interested in getting a common law jury in Pennsylvania as soon as possible.
Well, let me comment on that. One of the problems is getting into a court that will give you the common law. That's been a huge problem here in New York, and we've discovered in all the states pretty much of the union. We've had much communications with many people over the years that we've been doing this and discovering that the problems that we have discovered in New York is plagued throughout the nation. We, in the past year and a half, have been in the federal courts and have discovered the same problem there. And it's become really obvious that the 41st Congress back in 1871 did indeed create some legislation that has really robbed we, the people, of the Constitution. And I think it has taken from that time till today, and you know, how long it's been this severe, you know, it's how it's been creeping in, how fast or how slow, I don't know. I've only got a perception of it from when I got involved, and since I've been involved, it's totally corrupt from the day that I started to look into things and started to discover the corruption and finally come to the conclusion that it's completely corrupt. And now, there might be a judge here or a judge there, he's not going to last very long, who might give the common law, but it's very difficult to get it. And you can win some cases if you get the judge and put him in a box, so to speak. In other words, make him worried or concerned about your witness and your information that you're putting into his court, and how much control they have over expunging a lot of those things as time goes on to get the evidence away, because that's how I view their viewing it. But the bottom line is it's come pretty clear to me that when you're talking about the Constitution in the court, they're thinking of another Constitution. We're talking about the Constitution for the United States of America. They talk about a Constitution of the United States of America. Now, I have not seen this so-called second Constitution that a lot of people talk about. And I don't think it actually exists. I think what happens is they're using our Constitution, but they're overlaying it with some legislature that may even be spread out all over the place and, you know, weave together. But we do know that in 1871, there was the Act, I think it's called the Act of 1871, that created the federal city, which is Washington, D.C. There was no need to do that. That had already been there. And it is the city of the United States. It's a federal city. But they've created the District of Columbia out of it, and they called it, they've created some other kind of entity, and it has been taken over by enemies, foreign and domestic, just as Brent had mentioned a little earlier. And as time has went on, they have imprisoned us in this statutory court system, and we're trying to work our way out. We still have some pressure we're able to apply upon them by the way that we're filing here through National Liberty Alliance and through the Unified United States Common Law Grand Jury. We do have some pressure upon them because it's difficult for them to clean up or you know, remove the evidence that we're laying in the courts, because we lay them in all 94 courts, plus we fax out to all elected officials in America on the federal level and most on the state level. So it's difficult for them, and that's why we're probably a thorn in their side for that. And we can only do is keep putting the pressure on and keep moving towards that critical mass that we need. I heard Sheriff Clark from Milwaukee. He came to New York with the Oath Keepers here, and there was a dinner, and he had a speech. He was talking, and I just happened to listen to that today. Someone sent me a copy of the video on YouTube, so I listened to that video, and I was surprised. He mentioned a few things that made me think that maybe he's been paying attention to what we're doing. And he talked about critical mass and the need to come together, for the people to come together, and they're in National Liberty Alliance. So, you know, we're trying to move the people forward and to bring them together to offer education, communication, organization, counseling, if possible and when necessary, as best we can. And the key thing, really, is to keep putting pressures on the court. I think the habeas corpuses that we're filing is an extremely important program that we got going. It does numerous things. It puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the federal courts because every time they say no to a habeas corpus, they're saying no to due process. Every time they respond in the same way, which means they do nothing. They don't send it back. They don't tell us we can't. They just do nothing. That shows conspiracy, because they're all acting in uniform. They're all acting the same way across the nation. And we're going to all the chief judges. We give our habeas corpuses to the federal district courts. We give them to whatever district the court in question is in. We go right to the federal district court. We take the position that this is a Fifth Amendment concern, right of due process. And under Article 3, it is the federal court that has the jurisdiction to hear that. And so we're going to bring it to them. That's where our battle is, because we know that when we win in the federal courts, it's not if, it's when, providing God's will, of course, and we have the time to do it before they pull the plug. But by God's mercy, hopefully we'll get there before that happens. But when we win, and when we take back these courts, okay, that's when we'll start to get justice back in the courts. And we call that, I refer to that when we get to the other side, because right now we're on the side of evil. We're on the side of Babylon. We need to get on to the other side and put the king of the court, which ultimately is Jehovah, the God of the Bible, Jesus Christ. That is the king of the court. And we have to operate under his principles. And that's how courts need to go. Everyone within that courtroom, the judge, first of all, he should only be, particularly in common law courts or criminal courts particularly, or courts that are concerning crimes particularly, it needs to be a jury. And the judge is only a traffic cop, so to speak. You know, he keeps things moving and keeps them on point and gets the trial through and signs the papers on the end. Sort of he's the magistrate, and he's really signing off the facts that this is how the court went and this was the decision of the court. So he's just confirming it, notarizing it, if you may, as any magistrate has the power and the authority to do. But it is the people of the court, which is the juries, we the people, the local community, who make that decision. And we need to be able to do that under a sense of honor, justice, and mercy, under principles, and not under some restrictions or instructions of a judge or of a prosecuting attorney. And that's where we need to get to. So right now in Pennsylvania, to my knowledge, we haven't found a place where you can get common law. There may be courts called common law, but I doubt you'll get it there. If you do discover one, you can let us know. But order to get to that common law court, you need to join forces with we the people to put the pressure upon them to bring back our true courts, which is under the common law.
Well, according
I don't know
to
if Brent wants to comment on any of that, but go right ahead.
According to our Constitution, the judge took an oath of office to uphold the Constitution, and if he violates his oath of office, that's called perjury, which is a crime.
Right.
And so what
let me just interrupt you here just for a second. This is very important because I have been perplexed for the years that I've been involved in this in doing what we're doing. We have written lots of papers. We have filed lots of papers. We have been in many courts. We've heard these judges. We've heard from people what judges have said. And I'm so perplexed on how huge this fraud is, how huge this evil process has really gripped America on every level of our judiciary, from the federal right on down to the little town. It's gripped everything. And I scratch my head wondering, how is it that they feel so confident that they don't fear the fact that they're a fraud? Now, once in a while, I think you get a judge that kind of is a little worried, but he doesn't get worried until someone in the court brings up certain points and they worry them. And I've experienced that, and I think maybe that I've been part of that. But what I've realized is this. The only way they could be doing this, in my opinion, is that when you're talking about a constitution for the United States of America, they're thinking of a constitution of the United States of America. And that's the game. It's a game on words. We just talked at our meeting recently, at a local county meeting here that I'm involved with Liberty Groups, and we were talking about being a citizen, okay? National Liberty Alliance takes the position we're not going to allow them to rob our language. We are citizens. We are careful in how we use that in words when we write papers, but nevertheless, we're not going to run away from that. They don't own that word. And just because they call us a citizen doesn't make us a slave, because that's what they defined a citizen as. And, just because we're a person, and they've taken that word and they're making a person a corporation, just because they defined that doesn't mean anything. It's fraud. It's fraud against the people. It's fraud against the Constitution. It's war against the Constitution. It's war against the people. It doesn't give them the authority. It doesn't give them the right. And when we confront them on that, we have found on the federal level, they either get worried. On the state level, I think they're just too dumb to get worried. I just don't know what it is. Once in a while, they do get a little worried, but I don't know what it is. But it has got to be that they have this idea that they feel protected because they're playing a game on words and they're saying the right words, just like a lot of people think they can go into a court and say the right words and they're going to get some kind of justice in their unjust courts. It's not going to happen. I have found, and this is in the very beginning, this is before I even came into the court system on the way that I have, because I have tried to make arguments in court under contract law, and I have discovered every time I walk in a court, I never get to battle the individual on the other side. I got to battle that judge. Every move, every moment, every statement, everything I do, anything I put in a court, the judge has to confront me on it. Has to argue. What is it? Is this his case? And this has perplexed me for a long time, because he thinks I'm not a lawyer. He thinks he can get away with that, to begin with. But it shows how biased they are. It shows that they're in it for the other side. It shows that they're in it to win for either the corporation or to a lawyer, a person who's coming with a lawyer versus a person who's coming in without a lawyer. I have rarely gotten any kind of justice in a court when I came in battling my own personal concerns in a court without a lawyer. Almost all the time I lose, and I get disgusted with it because I know I've got the right position. It's the only
That's
reason
right.
I went in court.
But, my point is, if we had a sheriff who would do his duty and just remove one judge from the bench for violating his oath of office, the rest of them would toe the line. So we'll,
I would agree with that.
And so I'm really looking for a sheriff that has enough intestinal fortitude to do his job.
Join the club. That's what we're looking for, too. We do have a couple of them. We know that Sheriff Clark out there in Milwaukee, he's one of them. And there's a few others that we're finding here and there. We in Dutchess County, New York, right here in New York, we are getting ready. We, the people, coming together collectively under the Committee of Safety, which we just sparked up and actually organized just yesterday, Sunday. And that Committee of Safety is preparing now. In 30 days, we're going to talk with the sheriff, and we're going to put his feet to the fire. We're already delivering him a paper, but we want to organize a little better and come with resolutions and a seal and come in and with authority, and also coming in with people that are coming into our group that are elected individuals locally and who already know the sheriff. And so we're going to put the pressure on him, and we're going to put his feet to the fire. We want to know where he really stands. We want to understand what he's going to do in a state of emergency and who he's going to stand for. Is he going to allow his authority to be taken away and given? Or is he going to give his authority to someone else? What's he going to do when push comes to shove? And we have to do it delicately. And when we talk to this guy, as a matter of fact, I had brought up at the meeting that the next order of business is to start a discussion on how we might want to approach the sheriff, what kind of questions we might want to ask. And what we might want to ask is a follow-up maybe on a second time around, what we want to ask on the first time around. You know, we have to make a plan because we have to understand that a lot of these guys are ignorant. They're ignorant to the understanding of who they are and what authority they have. They're ignorant to the Constitution. They're ignorant of their job, period. And they're no different than you and I, by the way, because I, too, not long ago was ignorant, and I'm sure not too long ago, you, too, were probably ignorant, too, to these things. But we're discovering them. And we need to dig them up and get them out and start using the Constitution again for the United States.
Well, if you know of anyone, any sheriff or something in Pennsylvania, I'd sure appreciate if you'd let me know.
Well, just keep informed because we will be notifying people of sheriffs that we do know, and we're going to be working with committees of safety, Lord willing, across the nation. Let me see if Brent has any comments on any of these things or... Well, if we want to move to the next caller, Brent.
No, said plenty. You said plenty,
okay.
And I understand the frustration, too. I can say that much.
Yeah, it is really, I talk to people all the time, and the pressure and the stress on people by these evil people is just unbearable. And only we, the people, can save America. We, the people, have to step up, and we have to just do the right thing and put the pressure on the courts and the pressure on the system and the pressure on all these people that we elected, and we got to make them do the right thing. And if we can take control of the courts and get the administrations that we're planning into the system in every county in the nation, then we will enforce the Constitution, and we will start removing people from office by giving them indictments for not obeying, for bad behavior, for not obeying the Constitution and going outside and making war against the Constitution, war against the people. But first, of course, we have to let them know what they're doing. We have to make it clear to them, you know, and have communications. And when they still outright say, hey, we got a sheriff, by the way, you know, which we had talked to, we explained the law, what he was doing. He was participating in an evil process. And he came to the point where he said, yeah, well, I understand that, but nevertheless, I'm going to obey the courts. So he's made his decision, okay? That man needs to be removed from office for violation of his oath, for bad behavior, because judges and anybody in power and authority that has a duty gets to stay there as long as they're in good behavior. When they move into bad behavior and then we correct them and they refuse to be corrected from their bad behavior, we have every right, we have the authority, we the people ordained, we established this Constitution for them, and we will remove them. We can remove them by recall through the committee man process, which brings us to the Committee of Safety, or we can remove them through the grand jury by indicting them for making war against the Constitution, bring them into a court of law. They are in bad behavior. And that's what we got to do. That's how we, the people, can do this. And if we can clean up the courts and thereby clean up, of course, then the whole political process, making everybody obey the Constitution, we just corrected pretty much every problem in America at that point in time. And that's what we have to do.
Yeah, and I think you're right about the courts in this sense. They're the ultimate decision makers in individual instances, and that's where the real power is in government, but it's not paid much attention to. The attention goes to all the political baloney and the candidates, and those fellows aren't a pinch of nothing compared to the power to make decisions of right and wrong in individual instances, and that's the power of the courts. And of all the three branches of government in our common law tradition, independent branches, co-equal, the independence of the courts is more important than any of them. They all should be independent, but as they can increasingly or not, Congress increasingly, you know, the Republicans go along with everything that this fellow sitting in the White House is saying. Congress are lackeys for other powerful men. That all can happen, does happen. When it happened through the 1930s with Roosevelt, they rubber stamped everything Roosevelt said to do. He had absolute control of Congress. But if you have courts that are independent, you still stand a chance. You still have freedom, because in individual instances, they call the shots. And the jury, by the way, the jury is the final say, not to the courts, no, the jury in individual instances has final say in our country as a matter of our law and government.
Well, amen to that. Yeah.
Right now, right now what's happened is I know in Pennsylvania, our judges not only wear a black robe, but I believe they wear a crown.
Yeah, we all think that they're wearing one, too. Because they do come in and act like king. It's the king of their court. After all, they make decisions far and beyond their abilities and far beyond any authority we ever gave them. So, but look, we the people have to come in critical mass and continue this pressure until we hit that critical mass and then take back this nation. And we will do it. It's just a matter of time. It's coming by God's will and his mercy. All right, appreciate the call, Clayton.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right, let's take at least one more call for you, Brent. Is that good?
Oh, that's fine, yeah.
Okay, another caller. I don't know who the name is. It's 805 area code. You've been unmuted. 4874. Can you give us your first name and what state you're coming from?
This is Don, California. You hearing
Don
me right?
From California. Go right ahead, Don.
Yes.
I went to my alumni dinner Saturday, and an old school friend who's a retired deputy sheriff handed me this notice on NASARA, and I just would like to read. It says, returns constitutional law to all our courts and legal matters. It retrains all judges and attorneys in constitutional law, and there's about 17 others here, but how do we learn more about this NASARA Act?
I'd have to look it up. I'm not familiar with it. Did you just hear about it now? John, do you know?
I've heard the word before, but I don't know what it is. Gerard, have you heard about this?
It means National Economic Security and Reformation Act, NASARA.
Yeah, I have no idea what that is.
Is this a congressional thing or a state legislature thing?
It's congressional.
Okay. If you know any more about it, then more than you're saying, maybe you can email it to me. I'd like to know what you know about it.
Okay.
I'm not familiar with it either. But, I'd like to make a point here. And, really, I probably should have really tagged this onto the call before. But it's all about education. That's the key. Once they get central education, which is what they have in America, really it's centrally controlled, all of our education. But even worse, the Bar Association is centrally controlled. And it is the Bar Association that purposely, which is subversion against the United States of America, according to the code and according to logic and common law anyway. But when they go out and they purposely do not train the people in the common law. They do not train them in the Constitution and what the Bill of Rights is all about. And then they give them all this information concerning all this statutory stuff. And, of course, it's the Bar Association that's writing all this stuff up for Congress. How often do we see where a congressman, on TV, we'll see a congressman will grab a paper and when a bill went through and they didn't even get a chance to read it. And I remember on a couple occasions where a congressman picked up the papers and a big book and said, how do you expect us to read through this in 24 hours? It can't be done. And he says, this is what they're giving us. It's 24 hours to read through this. And I need like 24 lawyers to interpret all these different things in here. You see, Congress is not writing our laws. And Congress is also, they're receiving, someone else outside of our government is writing it. And it's going through the Bar Association because that's where the conspiracy all is. It become clear to me because they control the judges. They control who becomes a lawyer, who doesn't. They control everything in the system. And when a lawyer goes into a courtroom and starts to do things that maybe he shouldn't be doing, he's got to worry about that judge because that judge is going to put him straight, maybe even take him into the back room, I perceive, and also maybe even report him. And so it's a problem for any lawyer that wants to do the right thing. It's an uphill battle for them as much as it is for you and me in these courtrooms. It's really tough. But the conspiracy is all found in the education. And I can't tell you how many lawyers I've talked to, and they have no clue about anything in the Constitution. They have no clue on what common law really is at all, none whatsoever. And many of them will tell me that the common law has been done away with. We don't use that no more. I mean, that's ignorance, and where are they getting this from? They've been taught this in their schools. So this is where the problem is. The problem is in the education of we the people that we've been put underneath. And it's all a lie. And it's all really put out to destroy us. The immorality. You go into regular schools, any school, and it's like a militarized zone, especially in the city. You know, you got to go through. They got these people in uniform, and you got to go through the metal detectors in some of these schools or a lot of these schools. I mean, that's pretty bad that we have to do our children that way and set them up to be living in a militarized zone because that's what they're doing. Anyway,
John,
I guess I ranted too long.
Address here on the back of this flyer. It's www.nasaralaw.us.
Spell it.
NESARALAW.US.
Okay, I'll take a look.
Excuse me, NESARA, you say?
N as in nectar.
Oh, God, okay.
Nesara, NESARA, meaning National Economic Security and Reformation Act.
Okay. Just a minute. I want to make comment about what we're talking about.
And then LAW, right? And then LAW.US.
Yes.
Okay, got it.
Okay. LAW.US.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about this next week if you can discover anything on it, Brent, and I'll take a look myself.
Okay, I'll look and see, and we'll probably talk for that. I wanted to make one more point about this comes up continually, and it's a groundwork problem. This is part of the reason why, what I'm going to talk about is part of the reason why, in my studied opinion over many years, why the common law is as mysterious to people as the doctrine of the Trinity. How do you explain this? And people have struggled for centuries to try to define the common law. No one's ever been able to really say, okay, here's the definition. And the reason for that is this. And once you grasp this, then the common law starts to open up to you. Our common law, for whatever reason, it is of, as Justice James Wilson said, of origin divine. Origin divine, that means it is the law that's apparent in the nature of things. And it's not written down. It's something that we are responsible to observe and write down our observations. Our Constitution, Magna Carta, the laws of Edward the Confessor, the laws of King Alfred, the English Declaration of Rights, the covenants of the Covenanters of Scotland even, all those things were written down. They were their observations of what they saw in the nature of things, the law unwritten in nature, as Blackstone puts it. And when we write those things down, some court opinions are the same thing in a common law country. We have dissenting opinions. We have majority opinions. And we call them opinions. We call them opinions. We don't call them, you know, you have decrees. Those come out of the probate courts. Decrees come out of the family law court, the equity courts, chancery. That's canon law. That's civil law. That's a decree. But not on the common law courts. We just have opinions because we recognize that men at their best are still nothing more than men at best, and that ain't saying much. So we try to observe, write it down. Our common law then sometimes corrects itself, of course. But our common law is only known, and this is in our Constitution. Our common law is only known as it faces its antagonist. It is only known in adversity. It's only known in a conflict and a dispute. That's why the Constitution says that the only way you can get into a federal court is if you have a, I'm quoting, real case and controversy. It's got to be a genuine fight. There's got to be people with dogs in the fight. There's got to be life, liberty, or property at stake to a certain amount of money claimed. And all of that can together sharpens the fight. And if the fight ain't sharp in America, you don't get into court. And the common law is not known unless there's a fight. It is what we call it an adversarial tradition. The law of the city, by contrast, we call an inquisitorial tradition. They call themselves an inquisitorial tradition. They don't have trials. They don't have fights. They have inquisitions. That's where a judge and two lawyers or two people, attorneys, get together and decide what they're going to do with the poor parties before the court. We don't do that in America. We fight. And that's the thing they want to get rid of, too. And they're working hard at it. But, you know, courtroom drama, well, I mean, that's why Perry Mason was so well-known for so many years. And because it's all about the drama of conflict. And our adversarial tradition comes out of our common law, comes out of chivalry. It comes out of duels. All the rules are the same. The Queensberry rules, as our Supreme Court calls them, to follow the boxing rules. They say hard blows are acceptable. Foul blows are not acceptable under the Queensberry rules, and that's the way you're supposed to fight in court. But it is only known, our common law is only known, due process, that's what it is, and due process can't be defined either. It's only known as it emerges to the need. And the adversity causes to bob forth the truth and the need that is necessary at the time. And that's why we have individual instances. We don't have the broad brush of legislation or the decrees of a dictator. That's not our common law. When our common law, we don't look forward and say and tell people what to do. That's what legislation does. In our common law, we look backwards and we say, what happened? What happened? We don't fight until something happened, and it is retrospective. We don't try to control the future fundamentally in our common law tradition. There's another fundamental difference. Legislation is an attempt by men to preempt and control the future. Now, that's not always bad. In our state legislatures, they have the police powers that are under our Constitution of the United States. The federal government has no police powers within the boundaries of the several states of our union. Police powers are the powers over health, education, and welfare. Health, education, and welfare. That's why, of course, we say that the health care bill is unconstitutional. It's not mentioned in the Constitution to do this kind of thing. The federal government has no police powers in the United States. None. So how is it they're passing this? Well, that's what I'm saying. The police powers look forward and try to preempt people from doing this or making them do that. That's not our common law. Our common law lets people free. They don't have to seek permission to act. And if there's a conflict or a problem or a wrong, we ask the jury to look backward and tell us what happened, and then we apply the law to it, and that ends the matter. That's very much different, very much, than the rest of the world. That's how we define our common law, not by what it is. We define our common law by the way, the process, the courses it takes, because they are wholly opposite and wholly different to the law of the city, the rest of the world. And if you don't know those, you can't protect them. If you've been sucked into the education system, the world defines governments into seven types, and you've got to learn the characteristics, you've missed it. There are only two types. And, of course, there's gradations going one way and the other. Right now they're trying to drag us with little devices of the civil law. For example, habeas corpus on the federal level is now limited to a year. You've got 1 year. Statute of limitations, 1 year to get your habeas corpus in if you've been falsely imprisoned. You can't do it a year and a day later. And they got these forms you got to use. Well, all that is a whittling away at fundamental principles. And even Deuteronomy chapter 5, verses 1 through 4, tell us this. Do not take away. The word there, the Hebrew word means do not whittle. Do not whittle. Do not slowly shave away anything from the words, the things, the matters, the dvarim of this law. And those are fundamental things. And what are the fundamental matters of Deuteronomy chapter 5? If you remember, maybe you know the Bible, that's where the Ten Commandments are. Deuteronomy chapter 5. And all of the Bible is categorized in those. But it all comes down to the process and the difference between the two. They're wholly different, the way we do things and the way they do things in South America.
Okay. All right. Thank you, Don. Appreciate your question. Okay. Gerard, are you ready to take over? We're going to move over to Gerard now. Appreciate your time, Brent, and Woodwell. We'll see you next Monday. And stick around, and maybe if you want to pipe in from time to time, feel free. Gerard,
thank
are
you
here?
John.
Thank you.
I am.
Okay, you got the mic. Are you having problems on the control board? Because I see you went off and come back on again on the control board.
Oh, I didn't even realize it did. I didn't notice a thing. So we'll see what happens.
Oh, well, there you go. We'll see what happens. You got the control. I'm not going to touch it. Anybody else that has a question or a comment, hit star 6 to get into the queue, and Gerard will be taking questions, and I'll be in the background. I might disappear for a short while, but I'll be back. But go ahead, Gerard.
Okay, we have Robert from Illinois. You are unmuted.
Well actually, Krista from...
Okay,
yeah, you
take Krista. Yeah.
How are you?
Hey, Robert, just jump back in if that was a goof up. I thought I clicked on you and you kind of disappeared, so try again. But go ahead, Crystal.
Okay, first of all, I did contact I just came from a big meeting, so I got a lot of parents. We had about 500 parents, so I put that up for National Liberty Alliance. Secondly, that TV show, they're going to be calling you for, you know... So either you can come down or they'll put you on live. So they have your number on that. Also, I received another letter from the grievance committee stating that there's not enough evidence and that they want to take my house again next month, which, as I said, my house has been paid for. I got my proof. I filed all my paperwork and everything. And what was it? When I went there, because I said I had the proof, and I asked them for a sworn affidavit from the GE Credit Union and a notarized letter, which they never showed up for court. Also, I asked the attorney the same thing, and they're nothing but the debt collectors, and I asked them when did I, you know, sign a contract with them. So no one, again, showed up in court for nothing. So it's still up there in the air, and Connecticut is one of the states that doesn't even apply the constitutional laws. It's all political. So they got all their family and friends that are running everything. I think we discussed that before. And another thing, too, who's always on the news all over the country is Richard Blumenthal. And I think maybe we all need to write him letters and contact his office about this problem. Because he is very good to resolve a lot of things, and he's always on, you know. What do you think, on, you know?
Well, I don't know what Richard Blumenthal does. I guess maybe
Richard,
you know.
Richard Blumenthal is a senator. He's a senator. He's in Congress in Washington.
Mm-hmm.
But he's, like, right under Hillary, and he works along very close with President Obama also.
Yeah.
So he's on the TV every single day about all the things that whenever there's a problem or an issue or this and that. Just like, for example, there was a woman, they overpaid her $68,000 in Social Security. And he had that waivered for her. And he said that she didn't have to pay it back. And then they said that her her Social Security would be reduced, and she said she could not survive off that, so they left her Social Security as is. You know, and that was on our TV. So I said, wow. So I appealed my Social Security, too, because I said, what's good for the goose is good for, you know, everybody else. And,
Well, you know, just don't forget, when you have politicians up there doing things, they're doing things in front of everybody in order to make it look like they're working for us, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at, you know, he'll take one person and lift them up and parade them around. That's, you know, a lot of times that's the bread and circuses they're giving us, you know? In the meantime, on the bigger issues, his mouth is closed, you know? And that's generally what we see. And generally speaking, it's like, why do you go to their courts looking for justice? Because there is none.
Exactly. Well, that's why, you know, no, I don't even waste my time to go back to the court pertaining to this matter. But they wanted to start all over again for the 30th of July.
Yeah, it's a tough situation. And, you know,
as a matter of fact, the funny thing of it is, The balance would have been like $2,000. They put my mortgage back up to the original, and it was a PHH mortgage, which you can check on your website. PHH mortgage under, it was Columbus, Georgia. And the guy just won $21 million. They were also the same ones that tried to duke me out of mine. It's all nothing but a Ponzi scheme. And also what was that guy's name? He was a friend of Trump who had the illegal bank in Arizona in 2008 that was taking all the property. And when Ted Cruz came on, when they were in the debate, he is also the one, because I'll tell you, listening to these debates and what was going on, they just filled their guts about everything. He said that Donald Trump took that woman's property down in Atlantic City illegally on eminent domain. He perpetrated a fraud because an eminent domain is for highways and train stations. The rest of it is all perpetrated in a fraud. That's how they've been stealing people's land and everything else. And so Donald Trump, he made that remark and said, that's right, to make America look beautiful, we're going to do a whole lot more eminent domain. And I was in a place up here in Connecticut today, and I said, oh, my God, they're taking everyone's homes, businesses, and everything else.
Yeah, and that's all sort of tied in with Agenda 21. They believe that they have the right to seize property, even if they can give it to somebody else that will pay more tax on it, believe
yeah.
it or not. So that's such a wrongdoing. And, you know, the biggest weapon you have is light with that when it gets out there and people see it. You know, they don't operate good in the light. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, that's why when you have courtroom observers in the courts, that's the one thing that might make the judge nervous because, you know, his actions are being recorded by somebody else just then by the person he's abusing, so to speak. You know what I mean?
Well, you know what I got, too? When I went to court, I went back and I got all my transcripts. And I said, am I a public servant of this court? He said, no. I said, is this my grand jury? He said, no, I'm the grand jury. I said, well, you just committed a treason, and I want your resignation. He asked me to leave. So, and
you're
I got
lucky
all
he didn't drag you. You're lucky he didn't arrest you and drag you out.
Yeah, but I got all those in transcript. It's all in writing. You know?
Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, if you can put stuff on the record and get it out there, and if you have a way of distributing it, you know, that's where the alternative news media is very important in this battle.
Okay.
To get this, you know, in order to put the light on this stuff, you know?
Okay.
You know, and a lot of these guys are just so crooked. They're all making money. Don't forget that. Every time they
well,
bang
well, because it goes to them.
Money. Exactly.
Like, as I said, all of our property, everything was paid for. And also, did you hear of the birth bond?
The birth bonds? Yeah, you mean the birth certificate?
Our birth bond.
Yeah.
I just got mine.
Yeah, well, they claim that. Don't try to access it, though. I mean, if they put you in jail, they access it. Yeah. But don't you dare do it. They'll put you in jail.
Yes. That's no, but I got my number. It's everybody has their code number on our birth bond.
Yeah, and we've had some of our members that sit in court on different matters, especially things that end up turning criminal. And they read that. They read out the amount of the SESCU fund that comes from that birth bond. So, you know, it's not an imaginary thing that we're making up. It's definitely there.
Well, you know what I just learned, too? It was funny because in Canada, when a baby's born, they pay you. And I guess they're using their birth bond money. And in other countries that come here, because this gentleman, he was doing some work, and he goes, oh, no, we get a check every month. We always get a check. I don't know whether he was from Russia or Yugoslavia, one of the countries, you know? And I'm like, well, how do you get a check every month? And I then it's just like it was like almost making sense, like it must be off everybody's, you know, what we just discussed.
Yeah, there's different things. I mean, like Alaska has a lot of people that get money because because of the oil, and they pay especially like the natives that are there, and it's a shame because usually what happens is they take advantage and they ruin their work ethic and stuff with this oil money, you know. So even when they're doing you a favor, sometimes they're not really doing you a favor, you know.
Okay.
They're getting you dependent on the government, but. You know, look, we have so much money in this country. I also have heard that, like Texas, for example, if they wanted to give back all the capital reserve funds, these are things that they've invested in order to, let's say, fund a retirement system, and it got funded and refunded and refunded and has been making money through the years, and maybe they needed $1 million and they end up with $32 million in there, that money's supposed to reduce your taxes. That money's supposed to go back to the people. The government's not supposed to be in business to make money. And they have so much money in their capital reserve funds in Texas. They said they could give every man, woman, and child, a family of four, $20,000 a year for the next 20 years and still not be done bleeding off those extra funds.
But you were
so
just
that's,
talking
and
about...
That's not $20,000 per family. That's per person. 20, 40, 60, 80,000 a year. So that's a lot
like
of
you
money.
You were talking about with the Nassara. I just heard you make mention of that.
Yeah, somebody was talking about Nassara, and I'm not that familiar with it, but, you know.
Right. It is a stimulant. I guess people are going to be getting back soon or whatever. But I'll talk to you later on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I've been hearing stuff about that, too. But, but as I said, we need to get that other stuff with the transcripts and all that.
Yeah, like I said, the more you make that stuff public, that's the best you can do by putting it in there and making it part of the public record.
Right.
You know. And
exactly.
So, yeah. And look at they're gonna switch gears at some point, and they're gonna start dumping information about all the horrible things they've been doing to us, because, you know, when they think the time is right, they're going to use a shock treatment on us, and they're going to admit all kinds of nasty things that have been going on. They're going to, you know, the hidden things are no longer going to remain hidden.
Once the dark will come to the light, and it is starting to
right.
open up their faces.
But they're going to try to take advantage of that by making it, you know, people have to understand that they don't mind throwing a couple of their people under the bus if it serves their purpose.
Mm-hmm.
So you have to put everything in perspective and don't panic over it and don't get depressed over it.
Right.
Just know that this is that seven-headed hydra dying. You know what I mean? And so, you know, and they love to bring the bottom up so they can bring the top down. And I think that's where we are. I think we have to be aware of them making strife in the streets, because right now that's all they have left for, you know.
But you know, the most wonderful thing that came out last week, or like the past 2 weeks, is when Donald Trump made his remarks about, I think, the Mexican judge or a Muslim judge, and he said he wouldn't be treated fairly. And then I think it was, what's her name? Oh, God, she's in the Supreme Court. And they said, well, what do you think about when the other ones were making these decisions? Are they legally? You know what? I mean, it really put, I'm so glad Donald Trump said it, you know, because I'm going to be treated unfairly. What about everybody else being, because he's filthy rich, he got exemptions and stuff like that, but everybody else is being mistreated, and they can make the laws to protect who they want to protect. And he basically said, no, there is no justice for all, but just for me and just for the rich ones or whatever the case is, you know? And he shed a lot of light. They said, little Donald got to keep on talking because you're learning a lot by what he's saying, whether you agree or not. You know what I'm saying? He's not the sharpest tool, but I'll tell you what, he knows a lot of what he's saying, and he's exposing all the wrongdoings that they have been doing, including himself, you know?
Well, he doesn't mind using that system for his gain.
Oh, absolutely.
And it's all bread and circuses. I don't even listen to any of it because a bunch of baloney.
Exactly. But when he was talking about the eminent domain, I'm doing it. I'll take whatever I want and get away with it, you know?
Yeah, that's not a good attitude, but yeah.
It's a horrible attitude. But look at how the lies, you know, everything that we've been learning under the National Liberty Alliance and stuff like that, it's just like, wow. So we've all been shamed, the lies, this and that, but he literally got away with things so far.
The average person has to understand that, you know, you get all the justice that you can afford in America. If you got enough money, you can buy your way through. And people that have money, they get along, and because they can afford to pay what they need to pay and come out on the other side and still prevail. You know, but as things get harder and people can't pay, and we're going to end up with debtors' prisons and one of the ways they do that is they get you in court and they give you an order, and if you don't obey the order, then they hold you in contempt, they throw you in jail. How's that any different than a debtors' prison? You know,
So
it's tough. America's in a very sticky situation right now, and we're gonna be transitioning, and there's gonna be a lot of factions jostling for position here as things change. And so
it's just like Habakkuk. It's a short scripture in the Bible of three little chapters in Zechariah, and it says it all, especially about the judge, the injustice, and how everything is going to be exposed. And you know what? And the wicked, they are going to be having their day. You know, Satan's powerful, Jesus mighty, and Jehovah's almighty. And that's why keep on praying and keep on seeking, you know?
Yep, that's key. Keep your spiritual life there, because that's the tool that we have, because they're going to use smoke and mirrors on us, and the way you get through that is with your spiritual help, and that's very important.
And I read the Bible every day. And
right, system is gonna die.
Well, Satan knows he's
going to help facilitate it.
And Satan, we know Satan hates us, but Satan hates the evildoers too. So Satan will take them all so high, and when he pulls the four from under, who's going to be there to catch them?
There you go.
Know?
Yeah.
So.
Well, thank you, Crystal.
Okay.
Appreciate that. Yeah. Okay. Looks like we have Jeremiah from California. You've been unmuted. Go ahead.
What's up? How are you tonight, sir?
Pretty good.
Good. So I can ask you, and not much. I'm in a noisy area again. Got people around me talking, so I hope you guys don't mind. This is Donaldson, Jeremiah, calling from Northern California. I was want to ask you how you felt about the common law being located, the real common law being located in the local court rules. Excuse me. I'm talking on the phone. I'm only going to talk for 30 seconds. Okay. So the common law rules of are found, common law is found in the local rules of the court, not in the case law or decisions made by judges. You see, because that is a form of common law, but at the same time, that the if a judge is saying, hey, this is my court, you see, why is that? Chances are, you know, they're a locally elected judge. You know, there's a good I had an opportunity to meet a couple local judges in their trying to get elected to for office, and I asked them a couple of questions. I think I even came on the call and talked about it. But that's what actually clued me to this. And so my question for you is, how is, you know, like, can you hone in on that distinction for us on the call, so that way maybe we can, you know, if we'll know better how to address the situation if we're in the court and we know it's a local judge or if it's a state judge. What type of judge is it, you know? And this way we know better what the common law is, and also, can you verify that the common law is found in the local rules of the court? Thanks a lot.
Yeah, well, you know, any judge, you know, that says this is my court and that type of stuff, first of all, when a judge gives a ruling, he's not supposed to just give his opinion. He's supposed to give you by what authority he's ruling. You see, everything is in a framework. And what explains the Constitution is how is the way that it's been ruled on. That's part of your common law. And, you know, they like statutes because it makes things easier. They don't have to think, you know, and a lot of times they're getting away from common law because they want to stick strictly to the statute. And, you know, if we're going to have a strictly statute type situation, then you don't need a jury and you don't need a judge. You just need an IBM card with the holes punched in the right places. And when everything fits, then that's the situation and that's what you met out. Well, in real life, that's not the way things go. There's always an exception to a rule. Always. It doesn't matter. And that's where common law is supposed to be, because, you know, I think the biggest way to withhold the common law is not through the judges, but through the people. You know, you need true unfettered juries. That's how you get to the common law, because under a true jury, they can rule on not only the facts, but they can rule on the law, and they can rule on whether the law is being misapplied. And many judges are committing, you know, crimes telling the jury that they're only going to rule on the law as they give it, and they're not going to rule on the law. They're only going to rule on the facts. That, you know, what do you need me here for? Then stick an IBM card in there and make your decision. You know, human beings are complex, and like I said, there's an exception to every rule, and we have to take account for that. We can't just say, well, you know, the law is the law. I mean, a lot of times that's what goes on. It's not just that the law is the law. And sometimes the law is being misapplied, and like I said, there's an exception to everything for one reason or another, you know, and we have to allow for that. And the only ones who can allow for that is the people, we the people, and you know, when a particular court makes a decision on something, and they say, well, this is precedent, well, that's just because two things are a maxim of law.
Now,
just because
okay.
Two things are similar, they're not the same.
That's my point. Now, this is what I want to hit on right here. What you just said was crucial, because the case law, the precedent decisions, is a form of common law. However, it's not the common law. What I found by reading my first year writing an analysis in the law textbook, I think it's actually in the first chapter, but it mentions the fact that even though those precedent decisions are called common law, they are not the real common law, and that the actual common law itself is found in the rules of the quote-unquote courts. Okay? The other thing I wanted to quickly mention was that I started a chat room. I know you probably don't want to hear that, but it's 141644. That's the call-in pin on TalkShoe. So there's no audio. You have to call in using NLA's number, but you can chat through
Oh, you mean like, in other words, when this show is going. If you,
as
if
it's
you
going, that's correct.
And you put that code in, it's a chat room.
That's right, for this call. That's, I just went and started it tonight. So.
Okay, yeah.
It says NLA Monday's call. That's the call name, the username. And then if you just go ahead and, yeah, like 141-644 will get you to sign in and then come into a chat room. What's that?
Say that number slower because I missed it, and I'll bet you other people did. 141
sure.
What?
141-644.
And you go
just call,
for NL,
yeah,
NLA.
You, that's right. Just go into Talk Show Online. You don't even have to look for NLA. It's going to come up automatically once you punch in that PIN number into the key search. But that's just for convenience and everyone on the call to be able to chat. If, you know, since I'm on the call every week, I figured I'd maintain it. But
I got an email to that effect about Let's Use TalkShoe, and I didn't quite understand what they were talking about. I thought they wanted to move this whole thing over, but what you're talking about is just a chat room, and I think that's what the person was trying to tell me. And I didn't.
Yeah,
really,
and it's actually, it's going right now, and I don't see anyone else in there but me. And so, you know, that'd be kind of cool to see. You know, of course, there's a lot of important things being said, so there's, when you have a lot of important things being said, there's usually not a lot of activity in chat rooms either.
Right,
we don't need
right.
trolls, do we? But at the same, let's get back to my point, which was for you to comment on, which is, of course, about the rules of court and how those apply in a common law scenario when a person is trying to make a claim for the genuine common law as opposed to this precedent common law.
Yeah, and then there's American jurisprudence, which are the past decisions of judges. Judges are supposed to use that American jurisprudence when they're making decisions, because that's a collection of decisions that judges have made. You know, that's considered constitutional in those cases. But like I said, there's always an exception to the rule. That's what we have.
Well, let me
to
ask you, what are the rules of the court?
The rules of the court. Well, you know, there's a framework that it doesn't matter that the rules of the court are what they are. They got CPLR, whatever the rules are that have been established for the court as far as procedural go. But everything in this country is supposed to run under the framework of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights. So my kingdom ends where yours begins in common law, and I can't do anything that would usurp that. Regardless of what the law says, you know, you can't.
Right.
So
I just want to bring this up though, real quick. Is that when I was reading in my research, reading some history about the common law, it talked about its origins, and it was from the book called Judicial Process by a guy named Abraham. But what it was talking about was how the origins of common law come into play with regard to the courts that governed communities, rights and stuff like that, not necessarily the rights of individuals themselves, but because when you're talking about the people, you really are talking about the body politic and coming together as a unified, you know, political entity. So that's very important that the individual rights can be secured by the mass of people. It's true, although it's fiction. It's true when you get power, you know. I mean, that's just, it's pretty common knowledge, you know. But again, I want to say this, that if we look to the rules of the court, of the local court that you're in, if the judge says it's a state court, right, then there's a good chance that the municipality, even if it is a local court, they probably have some sort of like rules of the court that are in harmony with the state constitution, you see? And that constitution is going to be in harmony with the fundamental law of the land, which would be the United States Constitution. Now, I understand the ambiguity
that's
argument.
Right.
Go ahead.
That's the way it's supposed to work anyway, in theory.
Ideally.
Right.
But again, so I think that crucial part that we're missing, though, is that the rules of the court are a great place to look for the common law.
Mm-hmm. We have a problem in this country, though, because whenever somebody brings a case forward and it looks like they're going to prevail, and it's a case that runs contrary to some of the statutory law, what they'll do is they settle that case out of court and remove that file from the system so nobody can see it. See, you know, that's that whole business of where we go in and make a plea bargain, let's say. So a lot of the good cases, you never get to see the case law on it because they don't want to let that stand where everybody can learn what to do. And so a lot of times things are settled out of court and you never really get that true feeling for what's going on out there, because it's very necessary for them to control the system that they've built. So I think there's a lot of cases that are falling by the wayside because they make agreements and then they make non-disclosure agreements. And so you're missing out on all the good law that went through that somebody carried through that they were unable to rebut. And they make it so that those things never make it into the case law.
I get what you're saying. That is a problem, and it comes down to abuse of discretion. But that's definitely another can of worms. But real quick, I just want to read the source where I got that information from. It was from Writing and Analysis in the Law, first year lawyer's textbook, basically. I mean, I can give links to it, and I do that. We can post links in the chat room, but mm-hmm. That's why I'm hoping people will come in so we can start sharing some information. But it states, but they are not common law, talking about cases that interpret and apply statutes and case law, and become precedents in that jurisdiction. They are not common law because the legal rule that is being enforced originates with the legislature. Okay, and what's your opinion on this?
Well, that's interesting.
Go ahead.
Well, we have a lot of wrong that's going on in this country because of the legislature. You know, the legislature is promulgating a idea that as long as the legislator passes it, it's law. Well, a lot of what they're doing is unconstitutional, and just because the legislator passes a law doesn't mean that it fits with the Constitution. You know, they're trying to amend the Constitution through legislation. That's not how you amend the Constitution. And our forefathers weren't so short-sighted that they would have left open a avenue that we could legislate away the freedoms, the unalienable rights of the people, of the Bill of Rights. And that's what's going on today.
Right. And how is that going on?
Law, that's not constitutional.
But why? What's the purpose? Why? How is it happening? Here's the mechanics of it.
I think
it's happening because, Gerard, I'm sorry to be so assertive. I hope you can appreciate my assertiveness. But the way it's happening is that all legislative statutes and constitutional provisions pertain to some future occurrence, something that's supposed to happen in the future that you're not supposed to do, right? That is the sure shot sign to tell whether it's common law or not. If it's a rule or some sort of regulation that has to do with something that's supposed to occur or may occur in a future time or date, right, then the chances are it's not the common law. Because common law applies here and now to situations that literally occur, you know, in the local community, because you can't apply something for D.C. in California. You can't apply California law necessarily in Florida, you know. Even though I would like to help out in Oregon, I may not be able to have a similar application of the law or precedent. But, you know, the legislation is basically cast in general terms is what I'm getting at, and that it's got broad categories, okay, but because basically it's written to affect, again, future conduct rather than law written, you know, to decide specific mm-hmm. cases. So, but the specific case law is more of a now. This is where it gets critical. Cases can be either precedent based on statutory or based on rules of the court. And that is why it's important to know what case it is. Don't cite the wrong case, because it may not be the common law. It may be some statutory common law case. You see? And I just wanted to let that get information get out there so people listening could, if they're involved in the case, they could really get into comprehending, you know, what that case is really referring to. Is it relying on statutes? Is it relying on rules of the court? You know, that may help you, you know, someone succeed. But the other, let's see, what I think I wanted to kind of finish my call. I know there was some other people on that one had some questions.
Yeah, we have people waiting.
So that's about it for now. Again, the talk show chat room 141-644 for anyone that wants to get on.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Jeremiah.
Thank you.
Okay, we have Vermont. Harley, how you doing?
Oh, hi. That popped right up in my face. yeah, I was sitting here writing something on the chat room. Listen, I had one question about the constitutional sheriffs and wondering if we're making any progress on getting either, you know, Sheriff Mack or Clark to, you know, harmonize with us, join us, maybe come on the show when Brent's done.
Yeah, we've been trying to get sheriffs to come over, and we have a lot of, there's actually quite a few sheriffs, more out west that I know of, that are good sheriffs. And we have that list also that we were pursuing of all those people, and all those sheriffs that ran. I think there was 30 separate sheriffs that identify as constitutional sheriffs, and I don't know to what degree they are, but certainly groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center don't like them. And so, you know what they say, for enemy of my enemy is my friend. And those guys are the ones that I think that we should be contacting, because if the Southern Poverty Law Center is saying that these guys are constitutional extremists, then they're our buddies, aren't they? You know? So that's what we need to do. Now, I've been busy with stuff over here personal, and I haven't kept up with that. So I have to apologize for, you know, that I don't really know where we are as far as what's going on with that sheriff's committee, because I haven't been in contact with them lately, because I've been taking care of some personal stuff here, so I haven't been as active as I would like to be, you know, and that's a good point. And you know, everybody can help with that. It doesn't have to just be our sheriff's committee, because we should be doing it in our local communities. And if you happen to be one of the people that lives in that, in those states where those guys have raised up their heads, you know, that you want to make sure that he knows that you're on his side, because it's very, very important for these sheriffs to have local people supporting them. Because look at, they are a political animal. They are elected. And as much as we like to support the sheriff in Milwaukee, guess what? We can't vote for him, can we? So it's very important that they have a local, a contingent of local people, and you know, they should be very vocal. I don't want to say loud, but they should be vocal, because politically speaking, he needs that political clout. Because, you know, any sheriff that lifts his head up and they say, oh, he has the wherewithal to do it, well, guess what? He needs the people, because otherwise he's committing, you know, personal and political suicide in a certain sense, you know. If he doesn't have the support of his constituents, I mean, there's certain people that we know, like I think Sheriff Palmer over there, he gets elected every year. He's been through an awful lot of stuff, but I think he has the majority of the people in his county love him, and so he always gets elected, and so he's pretty secure in his county, at least.
It's like there's a couple of places that I have a strong feeling that, you know, all the sheriff documents and wonderful papers and, you know, discs and things don't go into the round file.
Well,
you
makes
know, and
you
I want to
move over there, doesn't it?
I watch a few streams on YouTube. I follow a few people. Are you familiar with Leo Stratton?
I have heard of Leo Stratton.
This guy has a six-part thing. It's up to six parts where he was speaking last month to a crowd that's talking our language, And he and some other places, somewhere I saw Mackey at a rally. He's going around, where people are running for constitutional sheriff, and they're talking the NLA talk, and the Leo Stratton there, man, he's digging up the stuff out in Oregon on what happened with the whole RICO mess and the Iron Triangle. And it just makes me think we need to triangulate. We need to write some maybe pointed paper that says very clearly to every constitutional group, liberty group, Tea Party, Oath Keeper, and especially constitutional sheriffs that we've got a wide open door. And, I know I've got a guy who tried his best in southern Vermont. You know, I keep hearing stories and back channel stuff. And I just know that he was just in the wilderness. And as far as I can tell, I'm the only official member in all of southern Vermont of the NLA. Now, I know there's somebody out there lurking. They need to sign up. We need to try to get people into, committees of safety, and that type of thing. But,
and I think that's the answer, to be honest with you, because, trouble is people don't take notice until they have a problem. And the problem with wait until you have a problem is it's usually too late, mm-hmm. what I mean? And so to be proactive, and we really, really got to embrace those sheriffs and those politicians, those legislators and different people that run on under constitutional grounds and encourage them. Because, look, they already stuck their heads up by making those statements and being put on the ballot. Some of them were elected. Some of them lost the election because of it. But nevertheless, we can't let them get their heads whacked down because they lifted their head up,
Well, that the Masonic network that holds the bar together and the police together, and those guys on some level are tightly organized. If mm-hmm. we can't out in the open at least have each other's backs and really be singing the same tune, and each of our organizations change a little bit if we have to harmonize, we're lost, man.
Yeah, and that's the other thing. We have a few people that are in NLA that are actually running for sheriff, and I think that's a great idea.
Super.
You got a small community, and you got some guy that's really not interested in doing the job. Step up to the plate and run. You don't even really need law enforcement experience. What you need is constitution experience. That's what you need. Let all those other guys worry about penal law and all that baloney. The fact of the matter is, it just takes common sense and a knowledge of the Constitution to do a good job,
Well, I'm going to do some video on my whole situation. I've got a guy who's been after the same bank down in Connecticut, and they came up to Vermont and took advantage of the laws up here being weak and not having no conflict of interest type laws because our communities are so small. We're kind of on the honor system, if you get my meaning. And right. Then I found out from a bar lawyer who was handling my Social Security that actually not only did they have control over the legal aid money, the bar, and they decide whether to fund it or not for any particular cause, and they opted down for anything for foreclosure, and that was their prerogative, apparently. They hold that purse string. And on top of that, they passed some laws to expedite the foreclosure process, stating that, it would help with the backlogs in the court. If there's bad cases, let the bad cases fall, but let the good cases have due process. So, they streamlined it in favor of these slick banks that come in and buy up all the state banks, and then they're under federal control. They're not under state
rules. Their whole process is using, even what they're doing here, they're bundling everything together, and they're using an in rem process, which is baloney. That's a violation of your due process rights.
And what I need to do is find it. Here's where my pointed question is, and I think habeas corpus, I have two. I have one going on for where they jailed me for unlawful trespass, and I think it's so skinny, and my record is so spotless, and they look like such monsters that I'm just aching to get in front of a jury just by my damn self without the habeas corpus and use their process to make them look stupid. But I'm getting the idea that I should use a habeas corpus in the federal level. Is that a good idea?
I think you end up there, ultimately, I think that's where I'm going to end up anyway, is that...
Well, they threw out my Supreme Court.
I've never seen much luck at the state level, to be honest with you.
Well, we already passed that Rubicon. You know, I mean, I did everything up. I've already been denied, you know, justice. They said that I missed some 10-day window two summers ago. You know, they've had me on grease skids ever since I've been fighting them and, you know, holding them off. And the point is I could never get representation. And, you know, there's no due process, no day in court, just like robo-copied friggin', you know, stamped documents and stuff served to me. So I'm appealing it all the way back, saying it's a moot point that I missed, you know, this 10-day or that 30-day thing.
Look at it, there's fraud.
So we are going to federal court. I just need to be able to construct a federal court document myself. So if you could point me where on the website maybe to find an example that I can, you know, reword.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. Well, we have federal cases that we've taken up into the federal court. I mean,
I'd love to have the help.
Well, look, at the federal court actually gives you more help than the state courts ever did. They have a clerk that's there just for pro ses. When I went up to the federal court here with John to file papers, there was a clerk there, and she was quite nice, actually, and she was quite helpful. You know, and so they're more willing to help up there for whatever the reason is. I don't know. And I don't know. I can't speak to every district. It just seems that the third district up here, Northern District, that whoever that clerk is and whoever those judges are, they seem to be more friendly to the people coming in. Well, so, you know, I don't know. Now, as far as there's federal cases that you can get online. And as a matter of fact, I'll call you because I came across some stuff. With the federal, because I've been interested in the same thing you're talking about. And ultimately, you know, it seems to me that you're going to end up in the federal in order to get your...
Definitely, that's the next stop. I mean, yeah. I've asked for reconsideration, I've written a second paper, you know, I've got all the... My problem is I've got way too much to throw at it. I need to be able to pare it down.
You got
to
keep it
in
simple.
A shoebox that actually gets me some damn results. And so, you know, this is something I was talking to, you know, folks the other night is, you know, are we getting mature enough that we can sort of look at things that have worked, you know, where they have and do a Venn diagram and, you know, sort of say, you know, here's worth it and this isn't worth it.
Right.
You've
been banging around for a while, so you have an ability. Not everybody has the abilities that you have. Like, you're more savvy with writing some paperwork and pushing it through the court, and that helps. You know, if you don't have
any... It's all dropped on the floor, though. I mean, they've just ignored everything. All I have is a documented train wreck, Gerard. I mean, all I have is a denial to speak and a denial of my constitutional rights. But, see, I need to be able to put Occam's razor on that thing and say this point, this point, this point, instead of having a shotgun approach where I just look like I'm writing an essay that they say just is totally null and void, you know?
Yeah, well, I think what the trick is that when you write your federal case, you have to write it very, very fundamental, you know, where they're actually violating your unalienable rights, and not really get into the other stuff. And you got to write it in such a way that federal judge understands that you understand that you're going to hold his feet to the fire in as far as what the state judges did. And look, at no federal judge is going to stick his neck out for a state judge. So very gently and carefully, gentle as a dove, but, you know, like a fox, you have to let him understand that his skin is on the line. And that's how you prevail, because at that point, he's not going to stick up for the state court and get his skin on the line. I mean, if he knows that you could move, that you're savvy enough to write a paper and that you can move into the federal courts. I mean, look at, you can add the federal judge to the case too. You know, I mean,
oh, I want to set the trap for Bear, you know, and I'm going to very carefully set it, you know, but I want to, let's Skype over this and we can share documents on Skype.
Yeah, and I just want to put one caveat there, though, and it's like, and Thornton, what Thornton says shines through, though, you know, in doing all what we're talking about, he says, there's nothing so frightful as ignorance in action, you know what I mean? If you tick off one of these guys and he has resources, he could do all the wrong things, and he's not doing it right, and yet you pay the price, you know what I mean? Because his ignorance is coming after you, and, I mean, you may end up getting him eventually, but, you know, by the time he gets done beating you up and singing his police force on you, you may not want to be there, you know what I mean? So you have to be careful that you're doing it in a very subtle type of way, and you always leave them an out. That's the other thing. You know, you never cage them in a corner and go after them. You got to give them something to hang their hat on, and at the federal level they will go. I mean, I've won some cases. I won a case at the local level, and the way it happened was is that it got ridiculous to the point that the judge was able to hang his hat on the stuff that I was saying because the other side didn't produce anything, and it went on long enough that he felt comfortable enough to rule for me because, you know, they probably got an unwritten rule. You never rule for the people. You always rule for the banks, and it was against a big bank like Citibank, and I think these judges understand that they can't be making cases prevail for the people against Citibank because, you know, those are the banks that are probably paying the bills in these judges' Sescu accounts or whatever kind of stupid deal they got going. I don't know, but you know what I mean.
Well,
so,
talk to Lee Stratton. People look him up on YouTube. You will be dumbfounded. The gentleman is articulate. He has done tons of research. He'll walk over to his table. Somebody asks him a question. He'll start talking again about how the Iron Triangle of these guys, they contribute to each other's campaigns. You know, they've all front-loaded this stuff, my friend. This is an asset strip on an international bankster level. Yeah. So I'll leave it there and let somebody else get in, but let's Skype later.
Yes, okay. Good talking to you, Harley. Thank you.
You too, buddy.
Yeah. Okay, boy, we can really go down some black holes here, can't we? Mr. Black, you are unmuted. I think it says Mr. Black. Yes. Are you there? What is it? Star 6.
Hello?
Yes, I can. Yes, go ahead.
Oh, how you doing today?
Very good.
Well, one of the questions I want to, well, a statement and a question, is that I think most of us need to understand that there's a ruling class that's basically ruling this country. And the ruling class is basically like the Bar Association. What is happening is England has never let this country go. They're still running this country. And these attorneys are always the ones bringing cases against you or your property, whether it's a mortgage foreclosure, whether it's a tax foreclosure, whether it's a criminal case. These statutes and codes, you know, attorneys, they write all these statutes and codes, and they do it to circumvent the Constitution. They do it all the time. And everybody in government making decisions, they're policing for profit under the executive level. They're legislating for profit under the legislative level. And they're adjudicating for profit. So one of the things that I see needs to happen is that a lot of the people need to start educating themselves and they become like voters and jurors. And they need to understand exactly what, you know, true common law is. And common law is quite simple. Most people say it's judge-made law, but the common law existed before there was any judges. And the highest court right now is the Supreme Court, and none of those justices are voted in. They're all appointed. That's why what they say are basic opinions that apply to corporations that really don't apply to me and you. But that's one of the things I want to, you know, speak about as far as the Bar Association basically, you know, has taken over the government. And I don't know. I think people go to court, and I think a lot of time we lose because we put the wrong arguments up. And we don't know exactly, you know, who we're going against. Like most of these foreclosures, people don't even know who they should be doing a counterclaim. They should be suing somebody. And people don't know who they're suing. They don't know who's even coming after them, who the real plaintiff is. So I mean, with these attorneys and this bar association, it's basically, you know, you have foreign interests in your pocket, and the way they get land back now, they get land back through bogus foreclosures and bogus tax sales. So all these foreign countries own land here in America, and these foreign countries really never even made a loan to even like claim to anything that we own. But that's one of the questions I wanted to ask. If it wasn't too in-depth, could you respond on that?
Well, you hit on a lot of stuff. And
pick one of them.
Look, the Supreme Court is not the supreme ruler of the law and the last word. It is to people. When you go to court, you have as much authority as that judge does, whether they know it or not. And actually, the decision of a jury trial is higher than the Supreme Court. There's no double jeopardy. It can't be second guessed, not even by the Supreme Court, because that's the people, that's the tribunal, that really is the highest court, because that's the jury of your peers ruling on something, and that's what we need to understand, and that's where we need to be. That's what we need to get these courts back to. You know, we have a problem with the whole jury selection and the tainted jury and all that, you know, but I would rather spend my time and effort fixing that, because if you fix that, look, you can fix this whole country through jury nullification. If people were educated and they knew how to rule properly and they knew what their proper place was in the law, you know, and everything would get straightened out, because, you know, you're supposed to have equal branches of government and separate, but the highest branch of government is we the people, is what it's supposed to be, you know.
Well, when you have ignorant jurors, and I don't think nobody should ever serve on a juror if they don't understand the Constitution, period.
And that's part of what we want to do. We want to make sure that when these juries come in, that they get an 8-hour, course that we give them. And look, you can bring the average person up to speed in 8 hours. If they have to sit in a classroom, you know, or even if you do 2-4 hours and say, look, this is what the law is, this is what the Constitution is, this is what your power as a juror is, I think they'd get an idea real quickly how they're supposed to rule. You know, if we could cut the misinformation out. Yeah, go ahead.
Well, one thing you got to understand is that when you're in court, you're really dealing with the First Amendment, the Second Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, and the Fifth Amendment. And people basically understand those amendments and the Seventh Amendment, you know, trial by jury of your peers. But a lot of these issues deal with, is somebody injured? Is there an injured party involved? And a lot of times there's no injured party. It's just a branch of government, you know, acting on the premise that they're going to make some money. And that's the biggest problem. Like, if you really don't have no injured party, you know, or somebody with a trespass or a loss, you shouldn't be in court. There's no case and controversy before the court. And the court's subject matter is cases and controversy. If there's no injured party, there's no case and controversy. That's why, Go ahead.
You're absolutely right. And the other point is that you can't say that the state is the injured party in a lot of this stuff, because that's what they're doing.
Well, even with these foreclosures, they're saying some investors bought some receivables, and you're liable, you know, for somebody buying some receivables on Wall Street. When, in fact, if you really have a true mortgage with a note, a bank's supposed to hold your note in a vault till you pay it off and give it back to you, not convert it into some security on Wall Street where you're obligated to some investors, you know, that allegedly bought something. So, you know, you have an attorney working for a servicer who's working for a debt buyer who's representing some investors that you don't even know who they are. The courts are supposed to work. You're supposed to, you know, it's supposed to be two parties going against each other, plaintiff and defendant. And there's never a plaintiff. Even with the tax sales, if say, you know, these attorneys, I mean, the city sells a debt to the attorney, and the attorney takes and put a lien on your property. They didn't get a lien. But what happened is these attorneys are stealing property and stealing land in America, and they're charging with these codes and these fines and these citations because, you know, they charge you $300, then, you know, you have to work anywhere between 4 days to a week to pay that back. So they're stealing your labor. They're stealing your labor. I mean, it's slavery for something there's no interest party. So the thing is, you know, I just think we need to work harder on educating jurors, and we need a system where, you know, even if you're not a registered voter, if you're here in America and you're an American, you should be able to go ahead and be on the jury. But, you know, you have to be a registered voter. And I don't think the framers of the Constitution ever made that stipulation for you to be able to vote. You have to be, I mean, for you to be a juror, you have to be a registered voter. What do you think of that?
You're absolutely right. I think you need to be, you know, living in the area, though. You know what I mean? You have to be a member of the community, I would think, you know. And you should be naturalized, probably. I don't think we want people coming over from foreign countries sitting on our juries, you know, I mean, just because they have nothing to do that day, you know. But you're right. Just look at it. Right now, I don't care to even vote, you know. So what does that mean? I can't be a juror? You know?
Yeah, I mean, the framers of the Constitution has never made that stipulation that you have to be a registered voter before you can be a jury. Now, I don't know where they get the crap at.
The whole fraud is that in order to be a registered voter, they want you to be a U.S. citizen under the District of Columbia, and go la, 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 we go on and on. That makes them all feel good about defrauding us, because they got some magic words or some other constitution we don't know about. But ultimately, it's all fraud. And you know, that's the thing. You know, when we go into their courts looking for justice, you know, the whole thing is a fraud anyway. And how do you reveal the fraud? And it's a delicate operation, because, you know, if you go in there swinging a bat too hard, they're gonna take your head off, because they're not gonna let you single handedly take down this system that they've been building for 100 years, that they've been padding their coffers with, you know.
Well, let me ask you this here. From my study, and I appreciate, you know, National Liberty and a couple other places where I study it, but it seems like when you're on a lower level, they deal with statutes and code when you're dealing with administrators, and then when you get like in the appellate court, they tend to deal more with the Constitution, constitutional rights. But on a lower level, the thing is they're padding their pockets, and they're mostly dealing with administrators, and not even judges. So I think that's a problem, too. I think, you know, a lot of times you want to move it up to like a higher court or a federal court. However, you know, one needs to do a removal, whether it's a writ of error, or whatever these writs are, those writs of rights, or move to the federal court, because when you're on a lower, level, everybody seems to be very crooked. The judges are wearing these robes; they're crooked. The prosecutors, they want to just get a conviction no matter what. The lawyers want to pad their pockets. So on a lower level, it's just very crooked. And I just think we need to find some way to move it up to the appellate court, because, like I said, on this here level, it's just so crooked where there's no equal protection under the law, and especially when they're making you pay to hear your case. And, you know, it's just – and it's all about money. It's just all about money. So
it absolutely is. But let me tell you something. Administratively, you know, look, at on the lower level, when you come into contact with these people, whatever you do, you have to have in your mind – that you're going to end up on the higher level. You're always preparing to be into the federal court whenever you do a case on the lower level. And part of that whole case, you know, you talk about, they always say, oh, well, you got to exhaust your administrative remedies before you go into the higher level. And the higher courts have been shirking their responsibilities by sending things back down to the state court and letting them rule on it instead of them ruling on it where they have jurisdiction. And, you know, once a state court rules on something, especially if there's a jury involved, what they did is they just created law, because the jury ruling on it, you know, there's no double jeopardy. And if it was a constitutional question, you know, it should have went up to that group that's supposed to do the constitutional questions. It shouldn't have came down to a question of a jury that can't be overturned. And so what they're doing is they're shirking their responsibility. And, you know, like there's been some 14th Amendment cases that they won't rule on, and they send them back and they let the states rule on them. And how can the states rule on a 14th Amendment, whether it's constitutional or not? Because one state might say it's unconstitutional and the other state says it is. And all of a sudden you have an amendment of the Constitution that applies in one state and doesn't apply in another. And that's a situation that our forefathers obviously never intended. So, you know, it's wrong. But I don't want to go off on a big tangent. The main thing is that you have to understand in these stupid administrative courts that they suck us into. Look at when that police officer walks up to the window, and he's accusing you of something. The exhaustion of your administrative remedies is right there at the window by not contracting with him, and you have to educate yourself on how you do that by what you say, and what you do, and what you say to the officer, because everything he's doing is designed to suck you into a contract. And this is why they feel comfortable doing the things they do on the lower end with their statute, is because we're ignorant to what's going on. And they may not even completely understand it, but they give them a skit to go by. And I do know somebody that just recently went through the police academy, the state police academy, and they're teaching them that when you walk up to the window of the car, you're contracting with that person. So this stuff is starting to come out. So, you know, if you rebut that right there, you know, at the window, that's the first step of exhausting your administrative redresses, because immediately he's violating your constitutional rights. See, that's what gives you the right to go into the higher court. And those are the case, and that's how you're going to argue it. That you didn't enter into a contract, you know what I mean, and that you don't recognize their authority over you. You know, look at, if there's no injured party, what's he doing? What's his?
That's correct.
You know what I mean? He's coming up and he's asking you. He's doing a presumption. He's presuming that you are under his authority, and it's up to you to rebut that. However you do it, and you got to do it without getting yourself in jail. You know what I mean? You have to do it kind of respectfully, but nevertheless, you have to do it. And I think the best thing that you can do is you always tape these conversations at that level. You know, then when you go into the judge, it's another round of, you know, do you understand? Do you stand under our authority and all that? And if you get good at it, you can bring all of these cases into the federal court, because when it comes out that you never contracted, and they're holding you and they're violating you under color of law, that's pretty powerful. And, you know, the federal judges, as crooked as that court may be and as crooked as they may be, if you actually construct a case with a paper trail where you can show that you didn't contract, they're not willing to stick their neck out for the lower court. You know what I mean?
I understand what you're saying. But a lot of times, these police officers and these DAs, they always use the term probable cause means, you know, reason suspicion. You know, what is it? Reason suspicion of what, an injured party. You have probable cause that there's an injured party or there's an injury. See, they don't put the injured party on the end of probable cause of an injured party or reason suspicion of an injured party. Just, you know, they leave that suffix off the, you know, that thing.
3 minutes.
Yeah, and it's up to, look at, you have to be savvy enough to in order to bring it back to where it needs to be, and that's the problem. You know what I mean? You have to educate yourself. And, you know, look at, if you ever can get yourself a jury trial at that level and you can actually argue, you could. I know people that have won with local jury trials, and that's why they don't like to let it go to a jury, because if you can put a good show on, you can win. And so where it's important to educate people so that when they get on a jury, they make the right decisions, you know?
Okay, well, I'm going to get off because it's only 3 minutes, so you can get in close. I'll call back in next week or tomorrow. But thank you very much for entertaining my question.
Yeah, you're welcome. Okay, Crystal, we only got a couple minutes. Go ahead. I'll see if I can help. We got Crystal from Connecticut.
Yes. Also, before I forget, they had on Channel 13... PBT, due process program, and it's from Rutgers University. And they were given all the definitions. I guess you can find it on the website.
Okay, so that's say that again. What channel was that?
It was on channel 13. Hold on, it is.
And it's from 13. Rutgers University.
It's from Rutgers University. Attorney Howard, I believe, I think that was the name. And it's she teaches us like on Saturday morning. I think at like 6 o'clock. Due process, no due process.
Well, that's encouraging that there's actually a university out there that's talking about due process, because that is the big thing right now in America. Well, we don't get due process. Ultimately.
And that was the course. And I said, oh, my God, as a matter of fact, I'll run it.
We should see if we could tape it. If you think it's good, you know what I mean, we should try to get that.
Absolutely, but it's on PBS on channel 13. But it's at Rutgers University. I know that's where the professor teaches.
Yeah, so maybe we can find something out. Maybe we'll be able to put some YouTube stuff on it and stuff.
Absolutely.
It's very encouraging to me that they're actually doing that, and it's coming out of one of the universities, because that's really what, you know, look, we need to be in the universities and in the colleges and
it's
the high
schools. It's at Rutgers University in New Jersey.
Yeah.
Okay.
So that's good. Anyway, we're kind of like out of time now, but I appreciate that. It's all about educating ourselves and our officials, and that's what it's about. So, you know, and we can all do that. Thank you very much. Yep. Okay.